thoroughly and then gulp them down. But these three are something special. They stand at the foundation of a huge skyscraper of books and films, those 20th century gothics, which have become known as the modern horror story. More than that, at the center of each stands, or slouches, a monster that has come to join and enlarge what Bert Hatlin calls the myth pool, that body of fictive literature in which all of us, even the non-readers and those who do not go to the films, have communally bathed. Like an almost perfect tarot hand representing our lusher concepts of evil, they can be neatly laid out. The vampire, the werewolf, and the thing without a name. One great novel of supernatural terror, Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, has been excluded from this tarot hand, although it would complete the grouping by supplying the best-known mythic figure of the supernatural, that of the ghost. I have excluded it for two reasons. First, because The Turn of the Screw, with its elegant drawing-room prose and its tightly woven psychological logic, has had very little influence on the mainstream of the American mass cult. We could do better discussing Casper the Friendly Ghost in terms of the archetype. Secondly, the ghost is an archetype, unlike those represented by Frankenstein's monster, Count Dracula, or Edward Hyde, which spreads across too broad an area to be limited to a single novel, no matter how great. The archetype of the ghost is, after all, the Mississippi of supernatural fiction, and although we will discuss it when the time comes, we'll not limit its summing up to a single book. All of these books, including The Turn of the Screw, have certain things in common, and all of them deal with the very basis of the horror story. Secrets best left untold and things best left unsaid. And yet Stevenson, Shelley, and Stoker, James too, all promise to tell us the secret. They do so with varying degrees of effect and success, and none of them can be said to have really failed. Maybe that's what kept the novels alive and vital. At any rate, there they stand, and it seems to me impossible to write a book of this sort without doing something with them. It's a matter of roots. It may not do you any good to know that your grandfather liked to sit on the stoop of his building with his sleeves rolled up and smoke a pipe after supper, but it may help to know that he emigrated from Poland in 1888, that he came to New York and helped to build the subway system. If it does nothing else, it may give you a new perspective on your own morning subway ride. In the same way, it is hard to fully understand Christopher Lee as Dracula without talking about that red-headed Irishman, Abraham Stoker. So, a few roots. 2. Frankenstein has probably been the subject of more films than any other literary work in history, including the Bible. The pictures include Frankenstein, The Bride of Frankenstein, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, The Revenge of Frankenstein, Blackenstein, and Frankenstein 1970, to name just a handful. In light of this, summary would seem almost unnecessary, but as previously pointed out, Frankenstein is not much read. Millions of Americans know the name, not as many as know the name of Ronald McDonald, granted, now there's a real culture hero, but most of them don't realize that Frankenstein is the name of the monster's creator, not the monster itself. A fact which enhances the idea that the book has become part of Hatlin's American myth pool, rather than detracting from it. It's like pointing out that Billy the Kid was in reality a tenderfoot from New York who wore a derby hat, had syphilis, and probably backshot most of his victims. People are interested in such facts, but understand intuitively that they aren't what's really important now, if indeed they ever were. One of the things that makes art a force to be reckoned with, even by those who don't care for it, is the regularity with which myth swallows truth, and without so much as a burp of indigestion. Mary Shelley's novel is a rather slow and talky melodrama, its theme drawn in large, careful, and rather crude strokes. It is developed the way a bright but naive debate student might develop his line of argument. Unlike the films based upon it, there are few scenes of violence. And unlike the inarticulate monster of the Universal days, the Karloff films, as Fory Ackerman so charmingly calls them, Shelley's creature speaks with the orotund balanced phrases of Peer in the House of Lords or William F. Buckley, disputing politely with Dick Cavett on a TV talk show. He is a cerebral creature, the direct opposite of Karloff's physically overbearing monster with the shovel forehead and the sunken, stupidly crafty eyes. And in all the book's pages, there is nothing as chilling as Karloff's line in The Bride of Frankenstein, spoken in that dull, dead, and dragging tenor, "Yes, dead, I love dead." Miss Shelley's novel is subtitled The Modern Prometheus, and the Prometheus in question is Victor Frankenstein. He leaves hearth and home to go to university in Ingolstadt, and already we can hear the whir of the author's grindstone as she prepares to sharpen one of the horror genre's most famous axes. "There are some things mankind was not meant to know," where he gets a lot of crazy and dangerous ideas put into his head about galvanism and alchemy. The inevitable result, of course, is the creation of a monster with more parts than a J.C. Whitney automotive catalog. Frankenstein accomplishes this creation in one long, delirious burst of activity. And it is in these scenes that Shelley offers us her most vivid prose. On the grave robbery necessary to the task at hand, "Who shall conceive the horrors of my secret toil as I dabbled among the unhallowed damps of the grave, or tortured the living animal to animate the lifeless clay? My limbs now tremble and my eyes swim with the remembrance. I collected bones from charnel houses and disturbed with profane fingers the tremendous secrets of the human frame. I kept my workshop a filthy creation. My eyeballs were starting from their sockets and attending to the details of my employment." On the dream, which follows the completion of the experiment, "I thought I saw Elizabeth, in the bloom of health, walking in the streets of Ingolstadt. Delighted and surprised, I embraced her, but as I imprinted the first kiss on her lips, they became livid with the hue of death. Her features appeared to change, and I thought that I held the corpse of my dead mother in my arms. A shroud enveloped her form, and I saw the grave worms crawling in the folds of the flannel. I started from my sleep with horror. A cold dew covered my forehead, my teeth chattered, and every limb became convulsed. When, by the dim and yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch, the miserable monster whom I had created. He held up the curtain of the bed, and his eyes, if eyes they may be called, were fixed on me. His jaws opened, and he muttered some inarticulate sounds, while a grin wrinkled his cheeks." Victor responds to this vision as any sane man would. He runs shrieking into the night. The remainder of Shelley's story is a Shakespearean tragedy, its classical unity broken only by Ms. Shelley's uncertainty as to where the fatal flaw lies. Is it in Victor's hubris, usurping a power that belongs only to God, or in his failure to take responsibility for his creation after endowing it with the life spark? The monster begins its revenge against its creator by killing Frankenstein's little brother, William. We are not terribly sorry to see William go, by the way. When the monster tries to befriend the boy, William replies, "Hideous monster, let me go. My papa is a syndic. He is Monsieur Frankenstein. He will punish you. You dare not keep me." This piece of rich kid snottiness is Willie's last. When the monster hears the name of its creator on the boy's lips, he wrings the kid's bratty little neck. A blameless servant in the Frankenstein household, Justine Moritz, is accused of the crime and is promptly hanged for it, thus doubling the unfortunate Frankenstein's load of guilt. The monster approaches his creator soon after and tells him the story. Much of the story is unintentionally hilarious. The monster hides in a shed adjacent to a peasant hut. One of the peasants, Felix, just happens to be teaching his girlfriend, a runaway Arabian noblewoman named Safi, his language. Thus, the monster learns how to talk. His reading primers are Paradise Lost, Plutarch's Lives, and The Sorrows of Werther, books he has discovered in a cast-off trunk lying in a ditch. This Baroque tale within a tale is only rivaled in Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, when Crusoe strips naked, swims out to the foundering ship that has marooned him, and then, according to Defoe, fills his pockets with all sorts of goodies. My admiration for such invention knows no bounds. The upshot of the matter is that he wants a mate. He tells Frankenstein that if his wish is granted, he will take his lady, and the two of them will live out their span in some desolate wasteland. South America is suggested, as New Jersey has not yet been invented, removed from the eye and mind of man forever. The alternative, the monster threatens, is a reign of terror. He voices his existential credo, better to do evil than do nothing at all, by saying, "I will revenge my injuries. If I cannot inspire love, I will cause fear, and chiefly towards you, my arch-enemy, because, my creator, do I swear inextinguishable hatred. Have a care. I will work at your destruction. I will desolate your heart, so that you shall curse the hour of your birth." At length, Victor agrees, and actually does make the woman. He accomplishes this second act of creation on a desolate island in the Orkney chain, and in these pages, Mary Shelley creates an intensity of mood and atmosphere that nearly rivals the creation of the original. Doubts assail Frankenstein moments before he is to imbue the creature with life. He imagines the world desolated by the pair of them. Even worse, he imagines them as a hideous Adam and Eve of an entire race of monsters. A child of her times, Shelley apparently never considered the idea that for a man capable of creating life from moldering spare parts, it would be child's play to create a woman without the capacity for conceiving a child. The monster turns up immediately after Frankenstein has destroyed its mate, of course. He has several words for Victor Frankenstein, and none of them are happy birthday. The reign of terror he has promised takes place like a chain of exploding firecrackers, although in Ms. Shelley's sedate prose they are more like a roll of caps. Frankenstein's boyhood friend, Henry Clerval, is strangled by the monster for openers. Shortly thereafter, the monster utters the book's most horrible innuendo. He promises Frankenstein, "I will be with you on your wedding night." The implications of this threat, for readers of Mary Shelley's time as well as our own, go beyond murder. Frankenstein responds to this threat by almost immediately marrying his childhood sweetheart, Elizabeth. Not one of the book's more believable moments, although hardly in a class with the abandoned trunk in the ditch or the runaway Arabian noblewoman. On their wedding night, Victor goes out to confront the creature, having naively assumed that the monster's threat is against himself. Meanwhile, the monster is broken into the small hut Victor and Elizabeth have taken for the night. Exit, Elizabeth. Frankenstein's father goes next, a victim of shock and heartbreak. Frankenstein pursues his demon creation relentlessly north, into the Arctic wastes, where he dies aboard the pole-bound ship of Robert Walton, another scientist determined to crack open the mysteries of God and nature. And the circle neatly closes. 3. So the question arises, how did it happen that this modest Gothic tale, which was only about 100 pages long in its first draft, Miss Shelley's husband Percy encouraged her to flesh it out, became caught in a kind of cultural echo chamber, amplifying through the years until, 164 years later, we have a cereal called Frankenberry, closely related to those two other favorites of the breakfast table, Count Chocula and Boo Berry, an old TV series called The Munsters, which has apparently gone into terminal syndication, a roar of Frankenstein model kits, which, when completed, delight the happy young model maker with a glow-in-the-dark creature lurching through a glow-in-the-dark graveyard, and a saying such as, "He looked like Frankenstein," as a kind of apotheosis of ugly. The most obvious answer to this question is the movies. The movies did it. And this is a true answer as far as it goes. As has been pointed out in film books ad infinitum and possibly ad nauseam, the movies have been very good at providing that cultural echo chamber, perhaps because, in terms of ideas as well as acoustics, the best place to create an echo is in a large empty space. In place of the ideas that books and novels give us, the movies often substitute large helpings of gut emotion. To this, American movies have added a fierce sense of image, and the two together create a dazzling show. Take Clint Eastwood and Don Siegel's Dirty Harry, for instance. In terms of ideas, the film is an idiotic mishmash. In terms of image and emotion, the young kidnapped victim being pulled from the cistern at dawn, the bad guy terrorizing the busload of children, the granite face of Dirty Harry Callahan himself, the film is brilliant. Even the best of liberals walk out of a film like Dirty Harry or Peckinpah's Straw Dogs looking as if they have been clopped over the head or run over by a train. There are films of ideas, of course, ranging all the way from Birth of a Nation to Annie Hall, but until a few years ago, these were largely the province of foreign filmmakers. The cinema New Wave that broke in Europe from 1946 until about 1965, and these movies have always been chancy in America, playing at your neighborhood art house with subtitles, if they play at all. I think it's easy to misread the success of Woody Allen's later films in this regard. In America's urban areas, his films and films such as Cousin, Cuisine, generate long lines at the box office, and they certainly get what George, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Romero calls good ink. But in the sticks, the Quad Cinema in Davenport, Iowa, or the Twin in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, these pictures play a fast week or two and then disappear. It is Burt Reynolds and Smokey and the Bandit that Americans really seem to take to. When Americans go to the films, they seem to want billboards rather than ideas. They want to check their brains at the box office and watch car crashes, custard pies, and monsters on the prowl. Ironically, it took a foreign director, the Italian Sergio Leone, to somehow frame the archetypal American movie, to define and typify what most American filmgoers seem to want. What Leone did in A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and most grandiosely in Once Upon a Time in the West, cannot even properly be called satire. Once Upon a Time in the West, in particular, is a huge and wonderfully vulgar overstatement of the already overstated archetypes of American film westerns. In this movie, gunshots seem as loud as atomic blasts. Close-ups seem to go on for minutes at a stretch. Gunfights for hours. And the streets of Leone's peculiar little western towns all seem as wide as freeways. So when one asks who or what turned Mary Shelley's well-spoken monster with his education from The Sorrows of Young Goethe and Paradise Lost into a pop archetype, the movies are a perfectly good answer. God knows the movies have turned unlikelier subjects into archetypes. Scuzzy mountain men matted with dirt and crawling with lice become proud and handsome symbols of the frontier. Robert Redford and Jeremiah Johnson. Or pick the Sun International picture of your choice. Half-witted killers become representatives of Americans' dying free spirit, Beatty and Dunaway and Bonnie and Clyde. And even incompetency becomes myth and archetype, as in the Blake Edwards Peter Sellers pictures, starring the late Sellers as Inspector Clouseau. Seen in the context of such archetypes, the American movies have created their own tarot deck, and most of us are familiar with the cards. Cards such as The War Hero, Audie Murphy, John Wayne, the strong and silent peace officer, Gary Cooper, Clint Eastwood, the whore with the heart of gold, the crazed hoodlum, top of the world, ma, the ineffectual but amusing dad, the can-do mom, the kid from the gutter who was on his way up, and a dozen others. That all of these creations are stereotypes developed with varying degrees of cleverness goes without saying, but even in the most inept hands, that reverberation, that cultural echo, seems to be there. But we're not discussing the war hero or the strong silent peace officer here. We are discussing that ever-popular archetype, the thing without a name. For surely if any novel spans the entire period of book into film into myth, Frankenstein is that book. It was the subject of one of the first story films ever made, a one-reeler starring Charles Ogle as the creature. Ogle's conception of the monster caused him to tease his hair and to apparently cover his face with partially dried bisquick. That film was produced by Thomas Edison. The same archetype is on view today as the subject of the CBS television series The Incredible Hulk, which has managed to combine two of the archetypes we are discussing here, and to do so with a fair amount of success. The Incredible Hulk can be seen as a werewolf story as well as a thing story. Although I have to say that each transformation from David Banner into the Hulk leaves me wondering where the hell the guy's shoes go to and how he gets them back. Old Greenskin is back, my 7-year-old son Joe is apt to say comfortably when David Banner begins his shirt-ripping, pants-shredding transformation. Joe quite rightly sees the Hulk not as a frightening agent of chaos, but as a blind force of nature fated only to do good. Oddly enough, the comforting lesson that many horror movies seem to teach the young is that fate is kind. Not a bad lesson at all for the little people, who so rightly see themselves as hostages to forces larger than themselves. So we begin with the movies. But what has turned Frankenstein into a movie not just once, but again and again and again? One possibility is that the storyline, although constantly changed, perverted, one is tempted to say, by the filmmakers who have used and abused it, usually contains the wonderful dichotomy that Mary Shelley built into her story. On the one hand, the horror writer is an agent of the norm. He or she wants us to watch for the mutant, and we feel Victor Frankenstein's horror and disgust at the relentless charnel creature he has made. But, on the other hand, we grasp the fact of the creature's innocence and the author's infatuation with the tabula rasa idea. The monster strangles Henry Clerval and promises Frankenstein he will be with him on his wedding night. But the monster is also a creature of childlike pleasure and wonder, who beholds the radiant form of the moon rising above the trees. He brings wood to the poor peasant family like a good spirit in the night. He seizes the hand of the old blind man, falls on his knees, and begs him, "Now is the time. Save and protect me. Do not desert me in the hour of trial." The creature who strangles Snotty William is also the creature who saves a little girl from drowning, and is rewarded with a charge of buckshot in the ass for his pains. Mary Shelley is, let us bite the bullet and tell the truth, not a particularly strong writer of emotional prose, which is why students who come to the book with great expectations of a fast, gory read, expectations formed by the movies, usually come away feeling puzzled and let down. She's at her best when Victor and his creation argue the pros and cons of the monster's request for a mate, like Harvard debaters. That is to say, she is at her best in the realm of pure ideas. So it's perhaps ironic that the facet of the book which seems to have ensured its long attractiveness to the movies is Shelley's splitting of the reader into two people of opposing minds, the reader who wants to stone the mutation and the reader who feels the stones and cries out at the injustice of it. Even so, no movie maker has gotten all of this idea. Probably James Whale came the closest in his stylish Bride of Frankenstein, where the monster's more existential sorrows, young Werther with bolts through his neck, are boiled down to a more mundane but emotionally powerful specific. Victor Frankenstein goes ahead and makes the female, but she doesn't like the original monster. Elsa Lanchester, looking like a latter-day Studio 54 disco queen, screams when he tries to touch her, and we are in perfect sympathy with the monster when he rips the whole rotten laboratory to pieces. A fellow named Jack Pierce did Boris Karloff's makeup in the original sound version of Frankenstein, creating a face as familiar to most of us, if slightly more ugly, as the uncles and cousins in a family photograph album. The square head, the dead white, slightly concave brow, the scars, the bolts, the heavy eyelids. Universal Pictures copyrighted Pierce's makeup, and so when Britain's Hammer Films made their series of Frankenstein movies in the late 50s and early 60s, a different concept was used. It is probably not as inspired or as original as the Pierce makeup. In most cases, the Hammer Frankenstein bears a closer resemblance to the unfortunate Gary Conway in I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, but the two have one thing in common. Although in both cases the monster is horrible to look at, there is also something so sad, so miserable there, that our hearts actually go out to the creature, even as they are shrinking away from it in fear and disgust. The greatest of the Hammer Frankenstein monsters was probably Christopher Lee, who went on to nearly eclipse Bela Lugosi as Count Dracula. Lee, the great actor, is the only man to approach Karloff's interpretation of the role, although Karloff was far more fortunate in matters of script and direction. All in all, Christopher Lee fared better as a vampire. As I've said, most directors who have tried their hands at a Frankenstein film, with the exception of those played exclusively for laughs, have sensed this dichotomy and tried to use it. Breathes there a moviegoer with soul so dead who never wished the monster would jump down from that burning windmill and stuff those torches right down the throats of those ignorant slobs so dedicated to ending its life? I doubt if there is such a moviegoer. And if there is, he must be hard-hearted indeed. But I don't believe any director has caught the full pathos of the situation. And there is no Frankenstein movie that will bring tears to the eyes as readily as the final reel of King Kong, where the big ape straddles the top of the Empire State Building and tries to fight off those machine-gun-equipped biplanes as if they were the prehistoric birds of his native island. Like Eastwood and Leone's spaghetti westerns, Kong is the archetype of the archetype. We see the horror of being a monster in the eyes of Boris Karloff, and later in those of Christopher Lee. In King Kong, it is spread across the ape's entire face, due to the marvelous special effects of Willis O'Brien. The result is almost a cartoon of the friendless, dying outsider. It is one of the great fusions of love and horror, innocence and terror, the emotional reality which Mary Shelley only suggests in her novel. Even so, I suspect she would have understood and agreed with Dino De Laurentiis' remark on the great attraction of that dichotomy. De Laurentiis was speaking of his own forgettable remake of King Kong, but he could have been speaking about the hapless monster itself when he said, "Nobody cry when Jaws die." Well, we don't exactly cry when Frankenstein's monster dies, not the way audiences weep when Kong, that shanghaied hostage of a simpler, more romantic world, topples from his perch atop the Empire State. But we are, perhaps, disgusted at our own sense of relief. 4. Although the gathering which ultimately resulted in Mary Shelley's writing of Frankenstein took place on the shores of Lake Geneva, miles from British soil, it must still qualify as one of the maddest British tea parties of all time. And in a funny way, the gathering may have been responsible not only for Frankenstein, published that same year, but for Dracula as well, a novel written by a man who would not be born for another 31 years. It was June of 1816, and the band of travelers, Percy and Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, and Dr. John Polidori, had been confined to quarters by 2 weeks of torrential rains. They began a joint reading of German ghost stories from a book called Phantasmagoria, and the gathering began to get decidedly weird. Things really culminated when Percy Shelley threw a kind of fit. Dr. Polidori noted in his diary, "After tea, 12 o'clock, really began to talk ghosts. Lord Byron read some verses of Coleridge's Christabel, the part about the witch's breast. When silence ensued, Shelley, suddenly shrieking and putting his hands to his head, ran out of the room with a candle. I threw water in his face and after gave him ether. He was looking at Mrs. Shelley and suddenly thought of a woman he had heard of who had eyes instead of nipples, which, taking hold of his mind, horrified him." Leave it to the English. An agreement was made that each member of the party would try his or her hand at creating a new ghost story. It was Mary Shelley, whose work as a result of the gathering would alone endure, who had the most trouble in setting to work. She had no ideas at all, and several nights passed before her imagination was fired by a nightmare in which a pale student of unhallowed arts created the awful phantom of a man. It is the creation scene presented in chapters 4 and 5 of her novel, quoted from earlier. Percy Bysshe Shelley produced a fragment entitled The Assassins. George Gordon Byron produced an interesting macabre tale titled The Burial, but it is John Polidori, the good doctor, who is sometimes mentioned as a possible link to Bram Stoker and Dracula. His short story was later expanded to novel length and became a great success. It was called The Vampire. In point of fact, Polidori's novel isn't very good, and it bears an uncomfortable resemblance to The Burial, the short story written by his immeasurably more talented patient, Lord Byron, there is perhaps a breath of plagiarism there. We do know that Byron and Polidori argued violently shortly after the interlude at Lake Geneva, and that their friendship ended. It is not entirely beyond supposition that the similarity between the two tales was the cause. Polidori, who was 21 at the time he wrote The Vampire, came to an unhappy end. The success of the novel he developed from his story encouraged him to retire from the doctoring profession and to become a full-time writer. He had little success at writing, although he was quite good at piling up gambling debts. When he felt his reputation had become irredeemably impugned, he behaved as we would expect of an English gentleman of the day, and shot himself. Stoker's turn-of-the-century horror novel, Dracula, bears only a slight resemblance to Polidori's The Vampire. The field is a narrow one, as we will point out again and again, and exclusive of any willful imitation, the family resemblance is always there, but we can be sure that Stoker was aware of Polidori's story. One believes, after reading Dracula, that Stoker left no stone unturned as he researched the project. Is it so far-fetched to believe that he might have read Polidori's novel, have been excited by the subject matter, and determined to write a better book? I like to believe this might be so, much as I like to believe that Polidori really did crib his idea from Lord Byron. That would make Byron the literary grandfather of the legendary Count, who boasts early on to Jonathan Harker that he drove the Turks from Transylvania, and Byron himself died while aiding the Greek insurgents against the Turks in 1824, 8 years after the gathering with the Shelleys and Polidori on the shores of Lake Geneva. It was a death of which the Count himself would have greatly approved. 5. All tales of horror can be divided into two groups, those in which the horror results from an act of free and conscious will, a conscious decision to do evil, and those in which the horror is predestinate, coming from outside like a stroke of lightning. The most classic horror tale of this latter type is the Old Testament story of Job, who becomes the human astroturf in a kind of spiritual Super Bowl between God and Satan. The stories of horror which are psychological, those which explore the terrain of the human heart, almost always revolve around the free will concept, inside evil, if you will, the sort we have no right laying off on God the Father. This is Victor Frankenstein creating a living being out of spare parts to satisfy his own hubris, and then compounding his sin by refusing to take the responsibility for what he has done. It is Dr. Henry Jekyll, who creates Mr. Hyde essentially out of Victorian hypocrisy. He wants to be able to carouse and party down without anyone, even the lowliest Whitechapel drab, knowing that he is anything but saintly Dr. Jekyll, whose feet are ever treading the upward path. Perhaps the best tale of inside evil ever written is Poe's The Telltale Heart, where murder is committed out of pure evil, with no mitigating circumstances whatever to tincture the brew. Poe suggests we call his narrator mad because we must always believe that such perfect, motiveless evil is mad, for the sake of our own sanity. Novels and stories of horror which deal with outside evil are often harder to take seriously. They are apt to be no more than boys' adventure yarns in disguise. And in the end, the nasty invaders from outer space are repelled. Or at the last possible instant, the handsome young scientist comes up with a gimmick solution, as when, in Beginning of the End, Peter Graves creates a sonic gun which draws all the giant grasshoppers into Lake Michigan. And yet it is the concept of outside evil that is larger, more awesome. Lovecraft grasped this, and it is what makes his stories of stupendous cyclopean evil so effective when they are good. Many aren't, but when Lovecraft was on the money, as in The Dunwich Horror, The Rats in the Walls, and, best of all, The Color Out of Space, his stories packed an incredible wallop. The best of them make us feel the size of the universe we hang suspended in, and suggest shadowy forces that could destroy us all if they so much as grunted in their sleep. After all, what is the paltry inside evil of the A-bomb when compared to Nyarlathotep, the crawling chaos, or Shub-Niggurath, the goat with a thousand young? Bram Stoker's Dracula seems a remarkable achievement to me because it humanizes the outside evil concept. We grasp it in a familiar way Lovecraft never allowed, and we can feel its texture. It is an adventure story, but it never degenerates to the level of Edgar Rice Burroughs or Varney the Vampire. Stoker achieves the effect, to a large degree, by keeping the evil literally outside for most of his long story. The Count is on stage almost constantly during the first four chapters, dueling with Jonathan Harker, pressing him slowly to the wall.
"Later, there will be kisses for all of you."
Harker hears him tell the three weird sisters as he, Harker, lies in a semi-swoon. And then he disappears for most of the book's 300 or so remaining pages. The Count appears on stage another half dozen times, most splendidly in Mina Murray Harker's bedroom. The men in her life burst into her room following the death of Renfield and are greeted with a scene worthy of Bosch. The Count clutching Mina, his face slathered with her blood. In an obscene parody of the marriage sacrament, he opens a vein in his own chest with one dirty fingernail and forces her to drink. Other glimpses of the Count are less powerful. We glimpse him once strolling along an avenue in a foppish straw hat, and once ogling a pretty girl like any run-of-the-mill dirty old man. It is one of English literature's most remarkable and engaging tricks, a trompe-l'oeil, that has rarely been matched. Stoker creates his fearsome immortal monster much the way a child can create the shadow of a giant rabbit on the wall simply by wiggling his fingers in front of a light. The Count's evil seems totally predestinate. The fact that he comes to London with its teeming millions does not proceed from any mortal being's evil act. Harker's ordeal at Castle Dracula is not the result of any inner sin or weakness. He winds up on the Count's doorstep because his boss asked him to go. Similarly, the death of Lucy Westenra is not a deserved death. Her encounter with Dracula in the Whitby churchyard is the moral equivalent of being struck by lightning while playing golf. There is nothing in her life to justify the end she comes to at the hands of Van Helsing and her fiancé, Arthur Holmwood, her heart burst apart by a stake, her head chopped off, her mouth stuffed with garlic. It is not that Stoker is ignorant of inside evil or the biblical concept of free will. In Dracula, the concept is embodied by that most engaging of maniacs, Mr. Renfield, who also symbolizes the root source of vampirism, cannibalism. Renfield, who is working his way up to the big leagues the hard way, he begins by snacking on flies, progresses to munching on spiders, then to dining on birds, invites the Count into Dr. Seward's madhouse, knowing perfectly well what he is doing. But to suggest he is a large enough character to take responsibility for all the terrors that follow is to suggest the absurd. His character, though engaging, is just not strong enough to take that weight. We assume that if Dracula hadn't gotten in by using Renfield, he would have gotten in another way. In a way, it was the mores of Stoker's day which dictated that the Count's evil should come from outside, because much of the evil embodied in the Count is a perverse sexual evil. Stoker revitalized the vampire legend largely by writing a novel which fairly pants with sexual energy. The Count doesn't ever attack Jonathan Harker. In fact, he is promised to the weird sisters who live in the castle with him. Harker's one brush with these voluptuous but lethal harpies is a sexual one, and it is presented in his diary in terms that were, for turn-of-the-century England, pretty graphic.
The girl went on her knees and bent over me, simply gloating. There was a deliberate voluptuousness which was both thrilling and repulsive, and as she arched her neck, she actually licked her lips like an animal, till I could see in the moonlight the moisture shining on the scarlet lips and on the red tongue as it lapped the sharp white teeth. There she paused, and I could hear the churning sound of her tongue as it licked her teeth and lips, and could feel the hot breath on my neck. I could feel the soft, shivering touch of the lips on the super-sensitive skin of my throat, and the hard dents of two sharp teeth, just touching and pausing there.
I closed my eyes in a languorous ecstasy and waited, waited with beating heart.
In the England of 1897, a girl who went on her knees was not the sort of girl you brought home to meet your mother. Harker is about to be orally raped, and he doesn't mind a bit. And it's all right, because he is not responsible. In matters of sex, a highly moralistic society can find a psychological escape valve in the concept of outside evil. This thing is bigger than both of us, baby. Harker is a bit disappointed when the Count enters and breaks up this little tête-à-tête. Probably most of Stoker's wide-eyed readers were, too. Similarly, the Count preys only on women. First Lucy, then Mina. Lucy's reactions to the Count's bite are much the same as Jonathan's feelings about the weird sisters. To be perfectly vulgar, Stoker indicates in a fairly classy way that Lucy is coming her brains out. By day, an ever more pallid but perfectly Apollonian Lucy conducts a proper and decorous courtship with her promised husband, Arthur Holmwood. By night, she carouses in Dionysian abandon with her dark and bloody seducer. In real life, at the same time, England was experiencing a mesmerism fad, although Franz Mesmer, the father of what we now call hypnotism, had been dead for about 80 years. Like the Count, many of Mesmer's disciples preferred young girls, and these 19th-century Svengalis would put their subjects into a trance by stroking their bodies all over. Many of the female subjects experienced wonderful feelings that seemed to culminate in a burst of pleasure. It seemed very likely that these culminating bursts of pleasure were in fact orgasms, but very few unmarried women of the day would have known an orgasm if it bit them on the nose, and the effect was simply seen as one of the pleasanter side effects of a scientific process. Many of these girls returned and begged to be mesmerized again. "The men don't know, but the little girls understand," as the Bo Diddley song goes. Anyway, the point made in regard to vampirism applies just as well to mesmerism. The culminating burst of pleasure was all right because it came from outside. She experiencing the pleasure could not be held responsible. These strong sexual undertones are surely one reason why the movies have conducted such a long love affair with the vampire, beginning with Max Schreck in Nosferatu, continuing through the Lugosi interpretation, 1931, the Christopher Lee interpretation, right up to Salem's Lot, 1979, where Reggie Nalder's interpretation brings us full circle to Max Schreck's again. When all else is said and done, it's a chance to show women in scanty nightclothes and guys giving the sleeping ladies some of the worst hickeys you ever saw, and to enact over and over a situation of which movie audiences never seem to tire, the primal rape scene. But maybe there's even more going on here sexually than first meets the eye. Early on, I mentioned my own belief that much of the horror story's attraction for us is that it allows us to vicariously exercise those antisocial emotions and feelings which society demands we keep stoppered up under most circumstances, for society's good and our own. Anyway, Dracula sure isn't a book about normal sex. There's no missionary position going on here. Count Dracula, and the weird sisters as well, are apparently dead from the waist down. They make love with their mouths alone. The sexual basis of Dracula is an infantile oralism coupled with a strong interest in necrophilia, and pedophilia, some would say, considering Lucy in her role as the bloofer lady. It is also sex without responsibility, and in the unique and amusing term coined by Erica Jung, the sex in Dracula can be seen as the ultimate zipless fuck. This infantile, retentive attitude toward sex may be one reason why the vampire myth, which in Stoker's hands seems to say, "I will rape you with my mouth and you will love it," instead of contributing potent fluid to your body, "I will remove it," has always been so popular with adolescents still trying to come to grips with their own sexuality. The vampire appears to have found a shortcut through all the tribal mores of sex, and he lives forever to boot. 6. There are other interesting elements in Stoker's book, all sorts of them, but it is the elements of outside evil and sexual invasion that seemed to have powered the novel most strongly. We can see the legacy of Stoker's Weird Sisters in the wonderfully lush and voluptuous vampires in Hammer's 1960 film Brides of Dracula, and also be assured in the best moralistic tradition of the horror movie that the wages of kinky sex are a stake through the heart while catching some Z's in your coffin, and dozens of other movies both before and after. When I wrote my own vampire novel, Salem's Lot, I decided to largely jettison the sexual angle, feeling that in a society where homosexuality, group sex, oral sex, and even, God save us, water sports, had become matters of public discussion, not to mention, if you believe the forum column in Penthouse, sex with various fruits and vegetables, the sexual engine that powered much of Stoker's book might have run out of gas. To some degree, that is probably true. Hazel Court, constantly falling out of the top of her dress, well, almost, in AIP's The Raven, 1963, looks nearly comic today, not to mention Bela Lugosi's corny Valentino imitation in Universal's Dracula, which even hardened horror aficionados and cinema buffs cannot help giggling over. But sex will almost certainly continue to be a driving force in the horror genre. Sex that is sometimes presented in disguise, Freudian terms, such as Lovecraft's vaginal creation, Great Cthulhu. After viewing this many-tentacled, slimy, gelid creature through Lovecraft's eyes, do we need to wonder why Lovecraft manifested little interest in sex? Much of the sex in horror fiction is deeply involved in power-tripping. It's sex based upon relationships where one partner is largely under the control of the other. Sex, which almost inevitably leads to some bad end. I refer you, for instance, to Alien, where the two women crew members are presented in perfectly non-sexist terms until the climax, where Sigourney Weaver must battle the terrible interstellar hitchhiker that has even managed to board her tiny space lifeboat. During this final battle, Ms. Weaver is dressed in bikini panties and a thin T-shirt, every inch the woman. And at this point, interchangeable with any of Dracula's victims in the Hammer cycle of films in the 60s. The point seems to be, the girl was okay until she got undressed. I thought there was another extremely sexist interlude in Alien, one that disappoints on a plot level no matter how you feel about women's ability as compared to men's. The Sigourney Weaver character, who is presented as tough-minded and heroic up to this point, steps out of character at the scriptwriter's whim by going after the ship's cat, enabling the males in the audience, of course, to relax, roll their eyes at each other, and say either aloud or telepathically, "Isn't that just like a woman?" It is a plot twist which depends upon a sexist idea for its believability, and we might well answer the question asked above by asking in turn, "Isn't that just like a male chauvinist pig of a Hollywood scriptwriter?" This gratuitous little twist doesn't spoil the movie, but is still sort of a bummer. The business of creating horror is much the same as the business of paralyzing an opponent with the martial arts. It is the business of finding vulnerable points and then applying pressure there. The most obvious psychological pressure point is the fact of our own mortality. Certainly it is the most universal, but in a society that sets such a great store by physical beauty, in a society, that is, where a few pimples become the cause of psychic agony, and sexual potency, a deep-seated uneasiness and ambivalence about sex becomes another natural pressure point, one that the writer of the horror story or film gropes for instinctively. In the bare-chested sword and sorcery epics of Robert E. Howard, for instance, the female heavies are presented as monsters of sexual depravity, indulging in exhibitionism and sadism. As previously pointed out, one of the most tried-and-true movie poster concepts of all time shows the monster, whether it be a B.E.M., bug-eyed monster, from This Island Earth, or the mummy for Hammer's 1959 remake of the Universal film, striding through the darkness or the smoking ruins of some city with the body of an unconscious lovely in its arms. Beauty and the Beast, you are in my power. Is that primal rape scene again? And the primal perverse rapist is the vampire, stealing not only sexual favors but life itself. And best of all, perhaps, in the eyes of those millions of teenaged boys who have watched the vampire take wing and then flutter down inside the bedroom of some sleeping young lady, is the fact that the vampire doesn't even have to get it up to do it. What better news to those on the threshold of the sexual sphere, most of whom have been taught, as certainly they have been, not in the least by the movies themselves, that successful sexual relationships are based upon man's domination and women's submission. The joker in this deck is that most 14-year-old boys who have only recently discovered their own sexual potential feel capable of dominating only the centerfold and playboy with total success. Sex makes young adolescent boys feel many things, but one of them, quite frankly, is scared. The horror film in general, and the vampire film in particular, confirms the feeling. Yes, it says. Sex is scary. Sex is dangerous, and I can prove it to you right here and now. Sit down, kid. Grab your popcorn. I want to tell you a story.
7.
Enough of sexual portents, at least for the time being. Let's flip up the third card in this uneasy tarot hand. Forget Michael Landon and AIP for the time being. Gaze, if you dare, on the face of the real werewolf. His name, gentle reader, is Edward Hyde. Robert Louis Stevenson conceived Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as a shocker, pure and simple, a potboiler, and, hopefully, a money machine. It so horrified his wife that Stevenson burned the first draft and rewrote it, injecting a little moral uplift to please his spouse. Of the three books under discussion here, Jekyll and Hyde is the shortest. It runs about 70 pages in close type, and undoubtedly the most stylish. If Bram Stoker serves us great whacks of horror in Dracula, leaving us, after Harker's confrontation with Dracula in Transylvania, the staking of Lucy Westenra, the death of Renfield, and the branding of Mina, feeling as if we had been hit square in the chops by a 2x4, then Stevenson's brief and cautionary tale is like the quick mortal stab of an ice pick. Like a police court trial, to which the critic G.K. Chesterton compared it, we get the narrative through a series of different voices, and it is through the testimony of those involved that Dr. Jekyll's unhappy tale unfolds. It begins as Jekyll's lawyer, Mr. Utterson, and a distant cousin, one Richard Enfield, stroll through London one morning. As they pass, a certain sinister block of building, with a blind forehead of discolored wall, and a door which is blistered and distained. Enfield is moved to tell Utterson a story about that particular door. He was on the scene one early morning, he says, when he observed two people approaching the corner from opposite directions, a man and a little girl. They collide. The girl is knocked flat, and the man, Edward Hyde, simply goes on walking, trampling the screaming child underfoot. A crowd gathers. What all of these people are doing abroad at 3 a.m. of a cold winter's morning is never explained. Perhaps they were all discussing what Robinson Crusoe used for pockets when he swam out to the foundering ship. And Enfield collars Mr. Hyde. Hyde is a man of so loathsome a countenance that Enfield is actually obliged to protect him from the mob, which seems on the verge of tearing him apart. "We were keeping the women off as best we could, for they were as wild as harpies," Enfield tells Utterson. Moreover, the doctor who was summoned turned sick and white with desire to kill him. Once again we see the horror writer as an agent of the norm. The crowd that has gathered is watching faithfully for the mutant, and in the loathsome Mr. Hyde they seem to have found the genuine article, although Stevenson is quick to tell us, through Enfield, that outwardly there appears to be nothing much wrong with Hyde. Although he's no John Travolta, he's certainly no Michael Landon sporting a pelt above his high school jacket either. Hyde, Enfield admits to Utterson, carried it off like Satan. When Enfield demands compensation in the name of the little girl, Hyde disappears through the door under discussion and returns a short time later with £100, 10 in gold, and a check for the balance. Although Enfield won't tell, we find out in due course that the signature on the check was that of Henry Jekyll. Enfield closes his account with one of the most telling descriptions of the werewolf in all of horror fiction. Although it describes very little in the way we usually think of description, it says a great deal. We all know what Stevenson means, and he knew we would because he knew, apparently, that all of us are old hands at watching for the mutant.
He is not easy to describe. There is something wrong with his appearance, something displeasing, something downright detestable. I never saw a man I so disliked, and yet I scarcely know why. He must be deformed somewhere. He gives a strong feeling of deformity, although I couldn't specify the point. He's an extraordinary-looking man, and yet I can really name nothing out of the way. And it's not for want of memory, for I declare I can see him this moment.
It was Rudyard Kipling, years later, and in another tale, who named what was bothering Enfield about Mr. Hyde. Wolfsbane and potions aside, and Stevenson himself dismissed the device of the smoking potion as so much hugger-mugger, it is very simple. Somewhere upon Mr. Hyde, Enfield sensed what Kipling called the mark of the beast. 8. Utterson has information of his own with which Enfield's tale neatly dovetails. God, the construction of Stevenson's novel is beautiful. It ticks smoothly away like a well-made watch. He has custody of Jekyll's will and knows that Jekyll's heir is Edward Hyde. He also knows that the door Enfield has pointed out stands at the back of Jekyll's townhouse. A bit of a swerve off the main road here. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was published a good 3 decades before the ideas of Sigmund Freud would begin to surface, but in the first 2 sections of Stevenson's novella, the author gives us a startlingly apt metaphor for Freud's idea of the conscious and subconscious minds, or to be more specific, the contrast between superego and id. Here is one large block of buildings. On Jekyll's side, the side presented to the public eye, it seems a lovely, graceful building, inhabited by one of London's most respected physicians. On the other side, but still a part of the same building, we find rubbish and squalor, people abroad on questionable errands at 3 in the morning, and that blistered and disstained door set in a blind forehead of discolored wall. On Jekyll's side, all things are in order, and life goes its steady Apollonian round. On the other side, Dionysus prances unfettered. Enter Jekyll here, exit Hyde there. Even if you're an anti-Freudian and won't grant Stevenson's insight into the human psyche, you'll perhaps grant that the building serves as a nice symbol for the duality of human nature. Well, back to business. The next witness of any real importance in the case is a maid who witnesses the murder which turns Hyde into a fugitive from the scaffold. It's the murder of Sir Danvers Carew, and as Stevenson sketches it for us, we hear echoes of every nasty murder to hit the tabloids in our time. Richard Speck and the student nurses, Juan Corona, even the unfortunate Dr. Herman Tarnauer. Here is the beast caught in the act of pulling down its weak and unsuspecting prey, acting not with cunning and intelligence, but only with stupid, nihilistic violence. Can anything be worse? Yes, apparently one thing. His face is not so terribly different from the face you and I see in the bathroom mirror each morning. And then, all of a sudden, he broke out in a great flame of anger, stamping with his foot, brandishing the cane, and carrying on like a madman. The old gentleman took a step back, with the air of one very much surprised and a trifle hurt. And at that, Mr. Hyde broke out of all bonds and clubbed him to the earth. And next moment, with ape-like fury, he was trampling his victim underfoot and hailing down a storm of blows, under which the bones were audibly shattered and the body jumped upon the roadway. At the horror of these sights and sounds, the maid fainted. All that's really lacking here to make the tabloid picture complete is a scrawl of Little Piggies or Helter Skelter on a nearby wall, written in the victim's blood. Stevenson further informs us that the stick with which the deed had been done, although it was of some rare and very tough and heavy wood, had broken in the middle under the stress of this insensate cruelty, and one splintered half had rolled in the neighboring gutter. Stevenson, here and in other places, describes Hyde as ape-like. He suggests that Hyde, like Michael Landon in I Was a Teenage Werewolf, is a step backward along the evolutionary scale, something vicious in the human makeup that has not yet been bred out. And isn't that what really frightens us in the myth of the werewolf? This is inside evil with a vengeance, and it is no wonder that clergymen of Stevenson's day held his story. They apparently knew a parable when they read one, and saw Hyde's vicious caning of Sir Danvers Carew as the old Adam coming out full blast. Stevenson suggests that the werewolf's face is our face, and it takes some of the humor out of Lou Costello's famous comeback to Lon Chaney Jr. and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Chaney, playing the persecuted skin-changing Larry Talbot, mourns to Costello,
"You don't understand. When the moon rises, I'll turn into a wolf."
Costello replies,
"Yeah, you and about 5 million other guys."
At any rate, Carew's murder leads the police to Hyde's Soho flat. The bird has flown the coop, but the Scotland Yard inspector in charge of the investigation is sure they'll get him, because Hyde has burned his checkbook.
"Why, money is life to the man. We have nothing to do but wait for him at the bank and get out the handbills."
But Hyde, of course, has another identity he can turn to. Jekyll, at last frightened back to reason, determines never to use the potion again. Then he discovers to his horror that the change has begun to occur spontaneously. He has created Hyde to escape the strictures of propriety, but has discovered that evil has its own strictures. In the end, he has become Hyde's prisoner. The clergy hailed Jekyll and Hyde because they believed the book showed the grim results of allowing man's baser nature more than the shortest possible tether. Modern readers are more apt to sympathize with Jekyll as a man looking for an escape route, if only for short periods, from the straitjacket of Victorian prudery and morality. Either way, when Utterson and Jekyll's butler, Poole, break into Jekyll's laboratory, Jekyll is dead, and it is the body of Hyde which they find. The worst horror of all has occurred. The man has died thinking like Jekyll and looking like Hyde. The secret sin, or the mark of the beast if you prefer, which he hoped to conceal, or to hide if you prefer, stamped indelibly on his face. He concludes his confession with the words,
"Here then, as I lay down the pen and proceed to seal up my confession, I bring the life of that unhappy Dr. Jekyll to an end."
It's easy, too easy, to get caught up in the story of Jekyll and his ferocious alter ego as a religious parable told in penny dreadful terms. It's a moral tale, sure, but it seems to me that it's also a close study of hypocrisy, its causes, its dangers, its damages to the spirit. Jekyll is the hypocrite who falls into the pit of secret sin. Utterson, the book's real hero, is Jekyll's exact opposite, because this seems important not only to Stevenson's book, but to the whole idea of the werewolf. Let me take a minute of your time to quote from the book again. Here's how he introduces Utterson to us on page 1 of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
"Mr. Utterson, the lawyer, was a man of rugged countenance that was never lighted by a smile. Cold, scanty, and embarrassed in discourse, backward in sentiment, lean, long, dusty, dreary, and yet somehow lovable."
I must admit that after reading Stevenson's description of Utterson, I found myself curious as to just how he was lovable.
"He was austere with himself, drank gin when he was alone to mortify a taste for vintages, and though he enjoyed the theatre, had not crossed the doors of one for 20 years.
About the Ramones, an amusing punk rock band that surfaced some 4 years ago, Linda Ronstadt is on record as saying, "That music's so tight it's hemorrhoidal." You could say the same thing for Utterson, who fulfills the function of court stenographer in the book and still manages to come off as the story's most engaging character. He's a Victorian prig of the first water, of course, and one would fear for a son or daughter brought up by the old man, but Stevenson's point is that there is as little of the hypocrite in him as there is in any man living. We may sin in thought, word, or deed, the old Methodist credo goes, and I suppose that by thinking of fine vintages while he knocks off his gin and water, we could say that Utterson is a hypocrite in thought. But here we're entering a fuzzy gray area where the concept of free will seems harder to grasp. The mind is a monkey, Robert Stone's protagonist muses in Dog Soldiers, and he is so right. The difference between Utterson and Jekyll is that Jekyll would only drink gin to mortify a taste for vintages in public. In the privacy of his own library, he's the sort of man who might well drink an entire bottle of good port, and probably congratulate himself on not having to share it, or any of his fine Jamaican cigars, either. Perhaps he would not want to be caught dead attending a risque play in the West End, but he is more than happy to go as Hyde. Jekyll does not want to mortify any of his tastes. He only wants to gratify them in secret. 9. What we're talking about here at its most basic level is the old conflict between id and superego, the free will to do evil or to deny it, or in Stevenson's own terms, the conflict between mortification and gratification. This old struggle is the cornerstone of Christianity, but if you want to put it in mythic terms, the twinning of Jekyll and Hyde suggests another duality, the aforementioned split between the Apollonian, the creature of intellect, morality, and nobility, always treading the upward path, and the Dionysian, god of partying and physical gratification, the get-down-a-boogie side of human nature. If you try to take it any further than the mythic, you come damn close to splitting the body and mind altogether, which is exactly the impression Jekyll wants to give his friends, that he is a creature of pure mind, with no human tastes or needs at all. It's hard to picture the guy sitting on the jakes with a newspaper. If we look at the Jekyll and Hyde story as a pagan conflict between man's Apollonian potential and his Dionysian desires, we see that the werewolf myth, in nominal disguise, runs through a great many modern horror novels and movies. Perhaps the best example of all is Alfred Hitchcock's film Psycho, although in all deference to the master, the idea was there for the taking in Robert Bloch's novel. Bloch, in fact, had been honing this particular vision of human nature in a number of previous books, including The Scarf, which begins with those wonderful eerie lines, "Fetish? You name it. All I know is that I've always had to have it with me," and The Deadbeat. These books are not, at least technically, horror novels. There is nary a monster or supernatural occurrence on view. They are labeled suspense novels. But if we look at them with that Apollonian-Dionysian conflict in mind, we see that they are very much horror novels. Each of them deals with the Dionysian psychopath locked up behind the Apollonian facade of normality, but slowly, dreadfully emerging. In short, Bloch has written a number of werewolf novels in which he has dispensed with the hugger-mugger of the potion or the wolf's bane. What happened with Bloch, when he ceased writing his Lovecraftian stories of the supernatural, and he never has completely, see the recent Strange Eons, was not that he ceased being a horror writer. He simply shifted his perspective from the outside, beyond the stars, under the sea, on the plains of Lang, or in the deserted belfry of a Providence, Rhode Island church, to the inside, to the place where the werewolf is. It may be that someday these three novels, The Scar, The Deadbeat, and Psycho, will be anthologized as a kind of unified triptych, as were James M. Cain's The Postman Always Rings Twice, Double Indemnity, and Mildred Pierce. For in their own way, the novels that Robert Bloch wrote in the 1950s had every bit as much influence on the course of American fiction as did the Cain Heal with a Heart novels of the 1930s. And although the method of attack is radically different in each case, both the novels of Cain and Bloch are great crime novels. The novels of both adopt a naturalistic view of American life. The novels of both explore the idea of protagonist as anti-hero, and the novels of both point up the central Apollonian-Dionysian conflict, and thus become werewolf novels. Psycho, the best known of the three, deals with Norman Bates, and as played by Anthony Perkins in the Hitchcock film, Norman is about as tight-assed and hemorrhoidal as they come. To the observing world, or that small part of it that would care to observe the proprietor of a gone-to-see backwater motel, Norman is as normal as they come. Charles Whitman, the Apollonian Eagle Scout, who went on a Dionysian rampage from the top of the Texas Tower, comes immediately to mind. Norman seems like such a nice fellow. Certainly Janet Lee sees no reason to fear him in the closing moments of her life. but Norman is the werewolf. Only instead of growing hair, his change is effected by donning his dead mother's panties, slip, and dress, and hacking up the guests instead of biting them. As Dr. Jekyll keeps secret rooms in Soho and has his own Mr. Hyde door at home, so we discover that Norman has his own secret place where his two personae meet. In this case, it is a knothole behind a picture, which he uses to watch the ladies undress. Psycho is effective because it brings the werewolf myth home. It is not outside evil, predestination. The fault lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. We know that Norman is only outwardly the werewolf when he's wearing Mom's duds and speaking in Mom's voice, but we have the uneasy suspicion that inside he's the werewolf all the time. Psycho spawned a score of imitators, most of them immediately recognizable by their titles, which suggested more than a few toys in the attic. Straightjacket. Joan Crawford does the axe-wielding honors in this gritty of somewhat overplotted film, made from a block script. Dementia 13, Francis Coppola's first feature film. Nightmare, a Hammer picture. Repulsion. These are only a few of the children of Hitchcock's film, which was adapted for the screen by Joseph Stefano. Stefano went on to plot television's Outer Limits, which we will get to eventually. 10. It would be ridiculous for me to suggest that all modern horror fiction, both in print and on celluloid, can be boiled down to these three archetypes. It would simplify things enormously, but it would be a false simplification, even with the tarot card of the ghost thrown in for good measure. It doesn't end with the thing, the vampire, and the werewolf. There are other bogeys out there in the shadows as well, but these three account for a large block of modern horror fiction. We can see the blurry shape of the thing without a name in Howard Hawks's The Thing. It turns out, rather disappointingly, I always thought, to be Big Jim Arnaz tricked out as a vegetable from space. The werewolf raises its shaggy head at Olivia de Havilland in Lady in a Cage, and as Betty Davis in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And we can see the shadow of the vampire in such diverse films as Them, and George Romero's Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. Although in these latter two, the symbolic act of blood-drinking has been replaced by the act of cannibalism itself as the dead chomp into the flesh of their living victims. Romero's Martin is a classy and visually sensuous rendering of the vampire myth, and one of the few examples of the myth consciously examined in film, as Romero contrasts the romantic assumption so vital to the myth, as in the John Badham version of Dracula, with the grisly reality of actually drinking blood as it spurts from the veins of the vampire's chosen victim. It is also undeniable that filmmakers seem to return again and again to these three great monsters, and I think that in large part it's because they really are archetypes, which is to say, clay that can be easily molded in the hands of clever children, which is exactly what so many of the filmmakers who work in the genre seem to be. Before leaving these three novels behind, and any kind of in-depth analysis of 19th-century supernatural fiction with them, and if you'd like to pursue the subject further, may I recommend H.P. Lovecraft's long essay, Supernatural Horror in Literature? It is available in a cheap but handsome and durable Dover paperback edition. It might be wise to backtrack to the beginning and simply offer a tip of the hat to them for the virtues they possess as novels. There always has been a tendency to see the popular stories of yesterday as social documents, moral tracts, history lessons, or the precursors of more interesting fictions which follow, as Polidori's The Vampire foreran Dracula, or Lewis's The Monk, which in a way sets the stage for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, as anything, in fact, but novels standing on their own feet, each with its own tale to tell. When teachers and students turn to the discussion of novels such as Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Dracula upon their own terms, that is, as sustained works of craft and imagination, the discussion is often all too short. Teachers are more apt to focus on shortcomings, and students more apt to linger on such amusing antiquities as Dr. Seward's phonograph diary, Quincy P. Morris's hideously overdone drawl, or the monster's lucky grab bag of philosophic literature. It's true that none of these books approaches the great novels of the same period, and I will not argue that they do. You need only compare two books of roughly the same period, Dracula and Jude the Obscure, let's say, to make the point pretty conclusively. But no novel survives solely on the strength of an idea, nor on its diction or execution, as so many writers and critics of modern literature seem sincerely to believe. These salesmen and saleswomen of beautiful cars with no motors. While Dracula is no Jude, Stoker's novel of the Count continues to reverberate in the mind long after the more ghoulish and clamorous Varney the Vampire has grown silent. The same is true of Mary Shelley's handling of The Thing Without a Name and Robert Louis Stevenson's handling of the werewolf myth. What the would-be writer of serious fiction, who would relegate plot and story to a place at the end of a long line headed by diction and that smooth flow of language, which most college writing instructors mistakenly equate with style, seems to forget is that novels are engines, just as cars are engines. A Rolls-Royce without an engine might as well be the world's most luxurious begonia pot, and a novel in which there is no story becomes nothing but a curiosity, a little mental game. Novels are engines, and whatever we might say about these three, their creators stoked them with enough invention to run each fast and hot and clean. Oddly enough, only Stevenson was able to stoke the engine successfully more than once. His adventure novels continued to be read, but Stoker's later books, such as The Jewel of Seven Stars and The Lair of the White Worm, are largely unheard of and unread except by the most rabid fantasy fans. In all fairness, it must be added that Bram Stoker wrote some absolutely champion short stories. The Squaw and The Judge's House may be the best known. Those who enjoy macabre short fiction could not do better than his collection, Dracula's Guest, which is stupidly out of print but remains available in the stacks of most public libraries. Mary Shelley's later gothics have similarly fallen into almost total obscurity. Each of the three novels we've been discussing is remarkable in some way, not just as a horror tale or as a suspense yarn, but as an example of a much wider genre, that of the novel itself. When Mary Shelley can leave off belaboring the philosophical implications of Victor Frankenstein's work, she gives us several powerful scenes of desolation and grim horror, most notably, perhaps, in the silent polar wastes, as this mutual dance of revenge draws to its close. Of the three, Bram Stoker is perhaps the most energetic. His book may seem overlong to modern readers and to modern critics who have decided that one should not be expected to devote any more time to a work of popular fiction than one might devote to a made-for-TV movie, the belief seeming to be that the two are interchangeable. But during its course, we are rewarded, if that's the right word, with scenes and images worthy of Doré. Renfield spreading his sugar with all the unflagging patience of the damned, the staking of Lucy, the beheading of the weird sisters by Van Helsing, the Count's final end, which comes in a hail of gunfire and a scary race against darkness. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a masterpiece of concision, the verdict of Henry James, not myself. In that indispensable little handbook by Wilfred Strunk and E.B. White, The Elements of Style, the 13th rule for good composition reads simply, omit needless words. Along with Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage, Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, James M. Cain's The Postman Always Rings Twice, and Douglas Fairbairn's Shoot, Stevenson's economy-sized horror story could serve as a textbook example for young writers on Hal Strunk's Rule Number 13, the three most important words in all of the textbooks ever written on the technique of composition, is best applied. Characterizations are quick but precise. Stevenson's people are sketched but never caricatured. Mood is implied rather than belabored. The narrative is as chopped and lowered as a kid's hot rod. We'll leave where we pick this up, with the wonder and terror these three great monsters continue to create in the minds of readers. The most overlooked facet of each may be that each succeeds in overleaping reality and entering a world of total fantasy. But we are not left behind in this leap. We are brought along and allowed to view these archetypes of werewolf, vampire, and the thing not as figures of myth, but as figures of near reality. which is to say, we are brought along for the ride of our lives. And this, at least, surpasses good. Man, that's great! Chapter 4. An Annoying Autobiographical Pause. Early on, I mentioned that trying to deal successfully with the phenomenon of terror and horror as a media-cultural event during the last 30 years would be impossible without a slice of autobiography. It seems to me that the time to make good on that threat has now arrived. What a drag. But you're stuck with it, if only because I cannot divorce myself from a field in which I am mortally involved. Readers who find themselves inclining toward some genre on a regular basis, Western, private eye stories, drawing room mysteries, science fiction, or flat-out adventure yarns, seem rarely to feel the same desire to psychoanalyze their favorite writer's interests and their own as do the readers of horror fiction. Secretly or otherwise, there is the feeling that the taste for horror fiction is an abnormal one. I wrote a fairly long essay at the beginning of a book of mine, Night Shift, trying to analyze some of the reasons why people read horror fiction and why I write it. I don't have any interest in reheating that hash here. If you're interested in pursuing that subject, I recommend the introduction to you. All my relatives loved it. The question here is a more esoteric one. Why do people have such an interest in my interest and in their own? I believe that, more than anything else, is because we all have a postulate buried deep in our minds that an interest in horror is unhealthy and aberrant. So when people say, "Why do you write that stuff?" they are really inviting me to lie down on the couch and explain about the time I was locked in the cellar for 3 weeks, or my toilet training, or possibly some abnormal sibling rivalry. Nobody wants to know if Arthur Haley or Harold Robbins took an unusually long time learning to use the potty, because writing about banks and airports and how I made my first million are subjects which seem perfectly normal. There is something totally American in wanting to know how things work, which goes a long way toward explaining the phenomenal success of the Penthouse Forum, I think. What all those letters are really discussing is the rocketry of intercourse, the possible trajectories of oral sex, and the how-to of various exotic positions, all as American as apple pie. Forum is simply a sexual plumbing manual for the enthusiastic do-it-yourselfer. But something unsettlingly alien about a taste for monsters, haunted houses, and the thing that crawled out of the crypt at midnight. Questioners automatically turn into reasonable facsimiles of that amusing comic strip psychiatrist, Victor de Groot, ignoring the fact that making things up for money, which is what any writer of fiction does, is a pretty bizarre way to earn a living. In March of 1979, I was invited to be one of 3 speakers on a panel discussing horror at an event known as the Ides of Mohonk, a once-yearly gathering of mystery writers and fans sponsored by Murder, Inc., a nifty mystery and detection bookshop in Manhattan. During the course of the panel discussion, I told a story that my mother had told me about myself. The event occurred when I was barely 4, so perhaps I can be excused for remembering her story of it, but not the actual event. According to Mom, I had gone off to play at a neighbor's house, a house that was near a railroad line. About an hour after I left, I came back, she said, as white as a ghost. I would not speak for the rest of that day. I would not tell her why I had not waited to be picked up or phoned that I wanted to come home. I would not tell her why my chum's mom hadn't walked me back, but had allowed me to come alone. It turned out that the kid I had been playing with had been run over by a freight train while playing on or crossing the tracks. Years later, my mother told me they had picked up the pieces in a wicker basket. My mom never knew if I had been near him when it happened, if it had occurred before I even arrived, or if I had wandered away after it happened. Perhaps she had her own ideas on the subject, but as I've said, I have no memory of the incident at all, only of having been told about it some years after the fact. I told this story in response to a question from the floor. The questioner had asked, "Can you recall anything in your childhood that was particularly terrible?" In other words, "Step right in, Mr. King. The doctor will see you now." Robert Marasco, author of Burnt Offerings and Parlor Games, said he could not. I offered my train story mostly so the questioner wouldn't be totally disappointed, finishing just as I have here, by saying that I could not actually remember the incident. To which the third panel member, Janet Jepson, who is a psychiatrist as well as a novelist, said, "But you've been writing about it ever since." There was an approving murmur from the audience. Here was a pigeonhole where I could be filed. Here was a by-God motive. I wrote Salem's Lot, The Shining, and destroyed the world by plague and the Stand because I saw this kid run over by a slow freight in the days of my impressionable youth. I believe this is a totally specious idea. Such shoot-from-the-hip psychological judgments are a little more than jumped-up astrology. Not that the past doesn't supply grist for the writer's mill. Of course it does. One example, the most vivid dream I can recall came to me when I was about 8. In this dream, I saw the body of a hanged man dangling from the arm of a scaffold on a hill. Rocks perched on the shoulders of the corpse, and behind it was a noxious green sky, boiling with clouds. This corpse bore a sign, Robert Burns. But when the wind caused the corpse to turn in the air, I saw that it was my face, rotted and picked by the birds, but obviously mine. And then the corpse opened its eyes and looked at me. I woke up screaming, sure that that dead face would be leaning over me in the dark. 16 years later, I was able to use the dream as one of the central images in my novel, Salem's Lot. I just changed the name of the corpse to Hubie Marston. In another dream, this is one which has recurred at times of stress over the last 10 years, I am writing a novel in an old house where a homicidal madwoman is reputed to be on the prowl. I'm working in a third-floor room that's very hot. A door on the far side of the room communicates with the attic, and I know, she's in there, and that sooner or later the sound of my typewriter will cause her to come after me. Perhaps she's a critic for the Times Book Review. At any rate, she finally comes through the door like a horrid jack from a child's box, all gray hair and crazed eyes, raving and wielding a meat axe. And when I run, I discover that somehow the house has exploded outward. It's gotten never so much bigger, and I'm totally lost. On awakening from this dream, I promptly scoot over to my wife's side of the bed. But we all have our bad dreams, and we all use them as best we can. Yet it is one thing to use the dream, and quite another to suggest the dream is the cause in and of itself. That is to suggest the ridiculous about an interesting subfunction of the human brain that has little or no practical application to the real world. Dreams are only mind movies, the scraps and remnants of waking life woven into curious little subconscious quilts by the thrifty human mind, which is loath to throw anything out. Some of these mind movies are of the X-rated variety. Some are comedies, some are horror movies. I think that writers are made, not born or created out of dreams or childhood trauma, that becoming a writer, or a painter, actor, director, dancer, and so on, is a direct result of conscious will. Of course, there has to be some talent involved, but talent is a dreadfully cheap commodity, cheaper than table salt. What separates the talented individual from the successful one is a lot of hard work and study, a constant process of honing. Talent is a dull knife that will cut nothing unless it is wielded with great force, a force so great that the knife is not really cutting at all, but bludgeoning and breaking. And after 2 or 3 of these gargantuan swipes, it may succeed in breaking itself, which may be what happened to such disparate writers as Ross Lockridge and Robert E. Howard. Discipline and constant work are the whetstones upon which the dull knife of talent is honed until it becomes sharp enough, hopefully, to cut through even the toughest meat and gristle. No writer, painter, or actor, no artist, is ever handed a sharp knife, although a few people are handed almighty big ones. The name we give to the artist with the big knife is genius. And we hone with varying degrees of zeal and aptitude. I'm suggesting that, to be successful, the artist in any field has to be in the right place at the right time. The right time is in the lap of the gods, but any mother, son, or daughter can work his, her way to the right place and wait. The thought is not original with me, but I'll be damned if I can remember who said it, so let me just credit that most prolific of writers, Mr. Author Unknown. But what is the right place? That is one of the great, amiable mysteries of human experience. I can remember going dowsing as a kid with my Uncle Clayton, a real old Mainer if one ever lived. We walked out, my Uncle Clayton and I, he in his red and black checked flannel shirt and his old green cap, me in my blue parka. I was about 12. He might have been in his late 40s or his late 60s. He had his dowsing rod under one arm, a wishbone-shaped piece of applewood. Applewood was the best, he said, although birch would do in a pinch. There was also maple, but Uncle Clay's scripture was that maple was the worst of the dowsing woods because the grain wasn't true and it would lie if you let it. At 12, I was old enough not to believe in Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, or dowsing. One of the odd things about our culture is that many parents seem honor-bound to lay all such lovely stories to rest in their children's minds as soon as possible. Dad and Mom may not be able to find time enough to help their little ones with their homework or to read them a story in the evening. Let them watch TV instead. TV's a great sitter. Lots of good stories. Let them watch TV. But they go to great pains to discredit poor old Santa and such wonders as dowsing and stumpwater witchcraft. There's enough time for that. Somehow, such parents find the fairy tales told on Gilligan's Island, The Odd Couple, and The Love Boat more acceptable. God knows why so many adults have confused enlightenment with emotional and imaginational bank robbery, but they have. They cannot seem to rest content until the wonder has flickered and died out of their children's eyes. "He doesn't mean me," you're whispering to yourself right now. "But sir or madam, I just might." Most parents quite rightly recognize the fact that children are mad, in the classic sense of that word. But I'm not altogether sure that killing Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy is the same thing as rationality. For children, the rationality of madness seems to work remarkably well. For one thing, it keeps the thing in the closet at bay. Uncle Clayt had lost very little of that sense of wonder. Among his other amazing talents, amazing to me at least, was the ability to line bees, that is, to spot a honeybee bumbling at a flower and then follow it back to its hive, tramping through woods, splashing through bogs, scrambling over deadfalls. His ability to roll his own cigarettes with one hand, always giving them that final eccentric twirl before sticking them into his mouth and lighting them with diamond matches kept in a small waterproof canister. And his seemingly endless fund of lore and tales, Indian stories, ghost stories, family stories, legends, you name it. On this day, my mother had been complaining to Clayt and his wife Ella over dinner about how slowly the water was drawing in the sinks and the toilet tank. She was afraid the well was going dry again. In those days, along about 1959 or 1960, we had a shallow dug well, and it went dry every summer for a month or so. Then my brother and I and our cousin hauled water in a big old tank that another uncle, Uncle Orrin that one was, for many years the best dam carpenter and contractor in southern Maine, had welded together in his workshop. We would perch the tank on the tailgate of an old station wagon and then lug it down to the well in a relay, using big galvanized steel milk cans. During that dry month or 6 weeks, we drew our drinking water from the town pump. So Uncle Clayt grabbed me while the women were washing up and told me we were going to douse my mother a new well. At 12, it was an interesting enough way to spend some time, but I was skeptical. Uncle Clayt might as well have told me he was going to show me where a flying saucer had landed behind the Methodist meeting hall. He walked around, green cap tilted back on his head, one of his bugler cigarettes jutting from the corner of his mouth, applewood stick held in both hands. He held it by the wishbone, wrists rotated outward, his big thumbs pressed firmly against the wood. We walked aimlessly around the backyard, the driveway, the hill where the apple tree stood, and still stands today, although new people live in that little five-room house. And Clayt talked. Stories about baseball. About an attempt to form a copper mining concern once upon a time in Kittery, of all places. About how Paul Bunyan was supposed to have turned the course of the Priestile Stream once upon a time to provide water for the logging camps. And every now and then he would pause, and the rod of that applewood dowser would tremble just a little. He would pause in his story and wait. The trembling might increase to a steady vibration and then fade out.
"You got something there, Stevie," he'd say. "Something, not too much."
And I would nod wisely, convinced he was doing it all by himself. Like the way it's parents, not Santa Claus, who put the presents under the tree, don't you know? Or the way they take away the tooth under your pillow after you're asleep and replace it with a dime. But I went along with them. I came from an age of children who wanted to be good, remember? We were taught to speak when spoken to, and to humor their elders, no matter how nutty their ideas might be. This is not a bad way of initiating children into the more exotic realms of human behavior and human belief, by the way. The quiet child, and I was one, is often given walking tours through some extremely bizarre tracts of mental countryside. I did not believe it possible to douse water with an applewood stick, but I was quite interested in seeing how the trick would be performed. We walked around onto the front lawn, and the stick began to tremble again. Uncle Clayt brightened.
"We got the real thing here," he said. "Look at this, Stevie. She's going to die. Be damned if she ain't."
3 steps further along, the applewood rod dove. It simply revolved in Uncle Clayt's hands and pointed straight down. It was a good trick, all right. I could actually hear the tendons in his wrists creak, and there was some strain on his face as he forced the straight part of the wishbone-shaped stick skyward again. As soon as he released the pressure, the stick whipped down at the ground again.
"Got plenty of water here," he said. "You could drink it until Judgment Day and it'd still run. It's close, too."
"Let me try it," I said.
"Well, you gotta back off a little first," he said.
And we did. We went back to the edge of the driveway. He gave me the stick, showed me how to hold it with my thumbs cocked just so, wrists outward, thumbs pointing down.
"Otherwise that son of a whore is going to break your wrist trying to point when you get over that water," Clayt said.
And then he gave me a little push on the ass.
"It don't feel like nothing but a piece of wood right now, does it?" he asked.
I agreed that this was so.
"But when you start getting close to that water, you're going to feel her come alive," he said. "I mean really alive, like it was still on the tree. Oh, applewood's good for dousing. Nothing beats applewood when you're hunting well water."
So, some of what happened could well have been suggestion, and I'm not trying to convince you otherwise, although I've read enough since then to believe that dousing really does work, at least at some times, and for some people, and for some crazy reason of its own. One of the more plausible explanations of the phenomenon is that the stick doesn't douse the water, the person holding the stick does, and then imputes the ability to the stick. Horses can smell water 12 miles away if the wind is right. Why should not a person be able to sense water 50 or 100 feet underground? I will say that Uncle Clayt had lulled me into that same state that I have tried again and again to lull the readers of my stories into, that state of believability where the ossified shield of rationality has been temporarily laid aside, the suspension of disbelief is at hand, and the sense of wonder is again within reach. And if that's the power of suggestion, it seems okay to me.
Better than cocaine for the brain.
I started walking toward the spot where Uncle Clayt had been when the rod dove, and I'll be damned if that applewood stick didn't seem to come alive in my hands. It got warm, and it began to move. At first it was a vibration that I could feel but not see, and then the tip of the rod began to jiggle around.
"It's working!" I screamed at Uncle Clayt. "I can feel it!"
Clayt got laughing. I got laughing, too. Not a hysterical sort of laughter, but one of pure and utter delight. When I got over the spot where the dousing rod dove for Uncle Clayt, it dove for me. At one moment, it was upright, and at the next, it was pointing straight down. I can remember 2 things very clearly about that moment. One was a sensation of weight. How heavy that wooden wishbone had become. It seemed I could barely hold it up. It was as if the water was inside the stick instead of in the ground, as if it were fairly bloated with water. Clayt had brought the stick up to its original position after it dove. I could not. He took it out of my hands, and as he did, I felt the sensation of weight and magnetism break. It did not pass from me to him. It broke. It was there at one moment, and at the next, it was gone. The other thing I remember is a combined feeling of certainty and mystery. The water was there. Uncle Clayt knew it, and I knew it too. It was down there in the earth, a river caught in rock for all we knew. It was that feeling of having come to the right place. There are lines of power in the world, you know, invisible but thrumming with a tremendous scary load of energy. Every now and then someone will stumble over one and get fried, or grasp one in the right way and set it to work. But you have to find one. Clayt drove a stake into the ground, where we had felt the pull of the water. The well did indeed go dry, in July instead of August, as a matter of fact, and as there was no money for a new well that year, the water tank made its yearly summer appearance on the tailgate of the station wagon, and my brother, my cousin, and I made our round trips down to the old well with the milk cans of water again. We did the same the following summer, but around 1963 or 64, we had the artesian well drilled. By then, the stake Clayt had driven was long gone, but I remembered its location well enough. The well drillers located their rig, that big red gadget that looked so much like some child's erector set vision of a praying mantis, within 3 feet of where the stake had been. And in my mind now, I can still hear Mom moaning about the wet clay that was spewed all over our front lawn. They had to go down less than 100 feet. And as Clayt had said on that Sunday when he and I walked out with that applewood rod, there was plenty of water. We could have drunk it until Judgment Day, and it still would have kept running.
2. I'm working my way back to the main point, this main point being why it is useless to ask any writer what he writes about. You might as well ask the rose why it is red. Talent, like the water Uncle Clayt doused out under our lawn after dinner one Sunday afternoon, is there all along. Except instead of water, it's more like a big, rude lump of ore. It can be refined or honed, to return to an earlier image, and it can be set to work in an infinite number of ways. The honing and the setting to work are simple operations, completely under the control of the fledgling writer. Refining talent is merely a matter of exercise. If you work out with weights for 15 minutes a day over a course of 10 years, you're going to get muscles. If you write for an hour and a half a day for 10 years, you're going to turn into a good writer. But, I hasten to add, only if you have the talent there to begin with. You can spend 10 years refining common earth and come out at the end with nothing but common earth, sifted fine. I've been playing guitar since the age of 14, and at the age of 33 I've not progressed much beyond where I was at 16, playing Louie Louie and Little Deuce Coupe on rhythm guitar with a group called the Moonspinners. I can play a little, and it sure cheers me up when I've got the blues, but I think Eric Clapton is still safe. But what's down there? That's the one great variable, the wild card in the deck. I don't think the writer has any control over that. When you drill a well and get the water, you send a sample to your state's water testing agency and get back a readout, and the mineral content can vary amazingly. All H2O is not created equal. Similarly, while Joyce Carol Oates and Harold Robbins are both writing English, they are really not writing the same language at all. There is a certain fascination inherent in the discovery of talent, although it is a difficult thing to write well about, and something I will not attempt at all.
"Leave it to the poets," he cried. "The poets know how to talk about that, or at least they think they do, and it comes to the same. So leave it to the poets."
That magical moment when the dowsing rod turns downward and you know that it is here, right here. There's also a certain fascination in the actual drilling of the well, refining the ore, honing the knife. Also a difficult thing to write well about. One saga of the heroic struggle of the young and virile writer that has always struck me well is Herman Woke's Youngblood Hawk. But what I really want to spend a couple of minutes talking about is another kind of dowsing. Not the actual discovery of talent, but that lightning stroke, which occurs when you discover not talent itself, but the particular direction in which that talent will incline. It is the moment, if you will, when a little leaguer discovers, not that he or she can pitch, which he/she may have known for some time, but that she or he has a particular ability to throw the good live fastball, or to pop a curve that rises or dips outrageously. This is also a particularly fine moment. And all of this, I hope, will justify the bit of autobiography that follows. It doesn't try to explain my own interest in the Danse Macabre, or justify it, or psychoanalyze it. It only tries to set the stage for an interest that has proved to be lifelong, profitable, and pleasant. Except, of course, when the madwoman pops out of her attic in that unpleasant dream house, in which my subconscious places me every 4 months or so. 3. My mother's people were named Pillsbury, and came originally, or so she said, from the same family that produced the Pillsburys, who now make cake mixes and flour. The difference between the two branches of the family, Mom said, was that the flour Pillsburys moved west to make their fortune, while our people stayed shirt-tail but honest on the coast of Maine. My grandmother, Nellie Pillsbury, née Fogg, was one of the first women ever to graduate from Gorham Normal School, the class of 02, I think. She died at age 85, blind and bedridden, but still able to decline Latin verbs and name all the presidents up to Truman. My maternal grandfather was a carpenter and, for a brief time, Winslow Homer's handyman. My father's people came from Peru, Indiana, and much further back, from Ireland. The Pillsburys, of good Anglo-Saxon stock, were level-headed and practical. My father apparently came from a long line of eccentrics. His sister, my Aunt Betty, had mental fugues. My mother believed her to be a manic depressive, but then Mom never would have run for president of the Aunt Betty fan club. My paternal grandmother enjoyed frying half a loaf of bread and bacon fat for breakfast, and my paternal grandfather, who stood 6'6" and weighed a cool 350 pounds, dropped dead at the age of 32 while running to catch a train. Or so the story goes. I've been saying that it's impossible to tell why one particular area strikes the mind with all the peculiar force of obsession, but that it's very possible to pinpoint that moment when the interest was discovered. The moment, if you will, when the dowsing rod turns suddenly and emphatically down toward hidden water. Put another way, talent is only a compass, and we'll not discuss why it points toward magnetic north. Instead, we'll treat briefly of that moment when the needle actually swings toward that great point of attraction. It has always seemed peculiar to me that I owe that moment in my own life to my father, who left my mother when I was 2 and my brother David 4. I don't remember him at all, but in the few pictures of him I've seen, he is a man of average height, handsome in a 1940s sort of way, a bit podgy, bespectacled. He was a merchant mariner during World War II, crossing the North Atlantic and playing German roulette with the U-boats. His worst fear, my mother said, was not of the submarines, but of having his master's license revoked because of his poor eyesight. While on land, he had a habit of driving over curbs and through stoplights. My own eyesight is similar. They look like glasses, but sometimes I think there are a couple of Coke bottle bottoms up there on my face. Don King was a man with an itchy foot. My brother was born in 1945. I was born in 1947, and in 1949, my father was seen no more. Although in 1964, during the troubles in the Congo, my mother insisted that she had seen him in a news clip of white mercenaries fighting for one side or the other. I suppose it is just barely possible. By then, he would have been in his late 40s or early 50s. If it was so, I sure hope he had his lenses corrected in the interim. After my father took off, my mother landed on her feet, scrambling. My brother and I didn't see a great deal of her over the next 9 years. She worked at a succession of low-paying jobs, presser in a laundry, donut maker on the night shift at a bakery, store clerk, housekeeper. She was a talented pianist and a woman with a great and sometimes eccentric sense of humor, and somehow she kept things together, as women before her have done and as other women are doing even now as we speak. We never had a car, nor a TV set until 1956, but we never missed any meals. We hopscotched our way across the country during those 9 years, always returning to New England. In 1958, we returned to Maine for good. My grandfather and grandmother were into their 80s, and the family hired my mother to care for them in their declining years. This was in Durham, Maine, and while all these family ramblings may seem far from the point, We're getting near to it now. About a quarter of a mile away from the small house in Durham where my brother and I finished our growing up, there was a lovely brick house where my mother's sister, Ethelyn Pillsbury Flaws, and her husband Orrin lived. Over the Flaws' garage was a lovely long attic room with loose rumbling boards and that entrancing attic smell. At that time, the attic connected with a whole complex of outbuildings, which in turn finally led to a great old barn. All of these buildings smelling intoxicatingly of sweet hay long departed, but there was a reminder of the days when animals had been kept in the barn. If one climbed to the third loft, one could observe the skeletons of several chickens that had apparently died of some strange disease up there. It was a pilgrimage I made often. There was something fascinating about those chicken skeletons, lying in a drift of feathers as ephemeral as moon dust, some secret in the black sockets where their eyes had once been. But the attic over the garage was a kind of family museum. Everyone on the Pillsbury side of the family had stored things up there from time to time, from furniture to photographs, and there was just room for a small boy to twist and turn his way along narrow aisles, ducking under the arm of a standing lamp or stepping over a crate of old wallpaper samples that someone had wanted saved for some forgotten reason. My brother and I were not actually forbidden the attic, but my Aunt Ethelyn frowned on our visits up there because the floorboards had only been laid, not nailed, and some were missing. It would have been easy enough, I suppose, to trip and go head first through a hole and down to the concrete floor below, or into the bed of my Uncle Orrin's green Chevy pickup truck. For me, on a cold fall day in 1959 or 1960, the attic over my aunt and uncle's garage was the place where that interior dowsing rod suddenly turned over, where the compass needle swung emphatically toward some mental true north. That was the day I happened to come on a box of my father's books, paperbacks from the mid-40s. There was a lot of my mother and father's married life in the attic, and I can understand how, in the wake of his sudden disappearance from her life, she would want to take as many of his things as possible and put them away in a dark place. It was there, a year or two earlier, that my brother found a reel of movie film my father had taken on shipboard. Dave and I pooled some money we had saved, without my mother's knowledge, rented a movie projector, and watched it over and over again in fascinated silence. My father turned the camera over to someone else at one point, and there he is, Donald King of Peru, Indiana, standing against the rail. He raises his hand, smiles, unknowingly waves to sons who were then not even conceived. We rewound it, watched it, rewound it, watched it again, and again. Hi, Dad. Wonder where you are now. In another box, there were piles of his Merchant Marine manuals. In another, scrapbooks of stuff from foreign countries. My mother told me that while he would go around with a paperback Western stuffed into his back pocket, his real interest was in science fiction and horror stories. He tried his own hand at a number of tales of this type, submitting them to the popular men's magazines of the day, Blue Book and Argosy among them. He ultimately published nothing. Your father didn't have a great deal of stick-to-it in his nature, my mother once told me dryly. And that was about as close as she ever came to ranking him out. But he did get several personal rejection notes. This won't do but send us more notes, I used to call them in my teens and early 20s, when I collected a good many of my own. During periods of depression, I would sometimes wonder what it would be like to blow your nose on a rejection slip. The box I found that day was a treasure trove of old Avon paperbacks. Avon, in those days, was the one paperback publisher committed to fantasy and weird fiction. I remember those books with great affection, particularly the shiny overcoating which all Avons bore, a material that was a cross between isinglass and saran wrap. When and if the story lagged, you could peel this shiny stuff off the cover in long strips. It made a perfectly wonderful noise. And although it wanders from the subject, I also remember the 40s Dell paperbacks with love. They were all mysteries back then, and on the back of each was a luxurious map showing the scene of the crime. One of those books was an Avon sampler. The word anthology was apparently considered too esoteric for readers of this sort of material to grasp. It contained stories by Frank Belknap Long, The Hounds of Tyndalos, Zelia Bishop, The Curse of Yig, and a host of other tales culled from the early days of Weird Tales magazine. Two of the others were novels by A. Merritt, Burn, Witch, Burn, not to be confused with the later Fritz Lieber novel, Conjure Wife, and The Metal Monster. The pick of the litter, however, was an H.P. Lovecraft collection from 1947 called The Lurking Fear and Other Stories. I remember the picture on the cover very well. A cemetery, somewhere near Providence, one assumes, at night, and coming out from beneath a tombstone a loathsome green thing with long fangs and burning red eyes. Behind it, suggested but not graphically drawn, was a tunnel leading down into the bowels of the earth. Since then I have seen literally hundreds of editions of Lovecraft, yet that remains the one which best sums up H.P.L.'s work for me, and I've no idea who the artist might have been. That box of books wasn't my first encounter with horror, of course. I think that in America you would have to be blind and deaf not to have come in contact with at least one creature or bogey by the age of 10 or 12. But it was my first encounter with serious fantasy horror fiction. Lovecraft has been called a hack, a description I would dispute vigorously, but whether he was or wasn't, and whether he was a writer of popular fiction or a writer of so-called literary fiction, depending on your critical bent, really doesn't matter very much in this context, because either way, the man himself took his work seriously, and it showed. So that book, courtesy of my departed father, was my first taste of a world that went deeper than the B-pictures which played at the movies on Saturday afternoon, or the boys' fiction of Carl Carmer and Roy Rockwell. When Lovecraft wrote The Rats in the Wall and Pickman's Model, he wasn't simply kidding around or trying to pick up a few extra bucks. He meant it, and it was his seriousness as much as anything else which that interior dowsing rod responded to, I think. I took the books out of the attic with me. My aunt, who was a grammar school teacher and the soul of practicality down to her shoes, disapproved of them strenuously, but I held on to them. That day and the next I visited the plains of Leng for the first time, made my first acquaintance with that quaint pre-Opec Arab, Abdul al-Hazred, author of the Necronomicon, which, to the best of my knowledge, has never been offered to members of the Book of the Month Club or the Literary Guild, although a copy was reputed to have been kept for years under lock and key in the Special Collections Vault at Miskatonic University. Visited the towns of Dunwich and Arkham, Massachusetts, and was, most of all, transported by the bleak and creeping terror of the color out of space. A week or two later, all of those books disappeared, and I never saw them again. I've always suspected that my Aunt Ethelyn might have been an unindicted co-conspirator in that case. Not that it mattered in the long run. I was on my way. Lovecraft, courtesy of my father, opened the way for me, as he had done for others before me. Robert Bloch, Clark Ashton Smith, Frank Belknap Long, Fritz Lieber, and Ray Bradbury among them. And while Lovecraft, who died before the Second World War, could fulfill many of his visions of unimaginable horror, does not figure largely in this book, the reader would do well to remember that it is his shadow, so long and gaunt, and his eyes, so dark and puritanical, which overlie almost all of the important horror fiction that has come since. It is his eyes I remember best from the first photograph of him I ever saw, eyes like those in the old portraits which still hang in many New England houses, black eyes which seem to look inward as well as outward, eyes that seem to follow you. 4. The first movie I can remember seeing as a kid was Creature from the Black Lagoon. I was at the drive-in, and unless it was a second-run job, I must have been about 7, because the film, which starred Richard Carlson and Richard Denning, was released in 1954. It was also originally released in 3D, but I cannot remember wearing the glasses, so perhaps I did see a re-release. I remember only one scene clearly from the movie, but it left a lasting impression. The hero, Carlson, and the heroine, Julia Adams, who looked absolutely spectacular in a one-piece white bathing suit, are on an expedition somewhere in the Amazon basin. They make their way up a swampy, narrow waterway and into a wide pond that seems an idyllic South American version of the Garden of Eden. But the creature is lurking, naturally. It's a scaly Batrachian monster that is remarkably like Lovecraft's half-breed degenerate aberrations, the crazed and blasphemous results of liaisons between gods and human women. I told you it's difficult to get away from Lovecraft. This monster is slowly and patiently barricading the mouth of the stream with sticks and branches, irrevocably sealing the party of anthropologists in. I was barely old enough to read at that time, the discovery of my father's box of weird fiction still years away. I have a vague memory of boyfriends in my mom's life during that period, from 1952 until 1958 or so. Enough of a memory to be sure she had a social life. Not enough to even guess if she had a sex life. There was Norville, who smoked Lucky's and kept three fans going in his two-room apartment during the summer. And there was Milt, who drove a Buick and wore gigantic blue shorts in the summertime. And another fellow, very small, who was, I believe, a cook in a French restaurant. So far as I know, my mother came close to marrying none of them. She'd gone that route once. Also, that was a time when a woman, once married, became a shadow figure in the process of decision-making and breadwinning. I think my mom, who could be stubborn, intractable, grimly persevering, and nearly impossible to discourage, had gotten a taste for captaining her own life. And so she went out with guys, but none of them became permanent fixtures. It was Milt we were out with that night, he of the Buick and the large blue shorts. He seemed to genuinely like my brother and me, and to genuinely not mind having us along in the back seat from time to time. It may be that when you have reached the calmer waters of your early 40s, the idea of necking at the drive-in no longer appeals so strongly, even if you have a Buick as large as a cabin cruiser to do it in. By the time the creature made his appearance, my brother had slithered down onto the floor of the back and had fallen asleep. My mother and Milt were talking, perhaps passing a cool back and forth. They don't matter, at least not in this context. Nothing matters, except the big black-and-white images up on the screen, where the unspeakable thing is walling the handsome hero and sexy heroine into the Black Lagoon. I knew, watching, that the creature had become my creature. I had bought it. Even to a 7-year-old, it was not a terribly convincing creature. I did not know then it was good old Riku Browning, the famed underwater stuntman, in a molded latex suit. But I surely knew it was some guy in some kind of a monster suit, just as I knew that later on that night he would visit me in the Black Lagoon of my dreams, looking much more realistic. He might be waiting in the closet when we got back. He might be standing slumped in the blackness of the bathroom at the end of the hall, stinking of algae and swamp rot, all ready for a post-midnight snack of small boy. 7 isn't old, but it is old enough to know that you get what you pay for. You own it, you bought it, it's yours. It is old enough to feel the douser suddenly come alive, grow heavy, and roll over in your hands, pointing at hidden water. My reaction to the creature on that night was perhaps the perfect reaction, the one every writer of horror fiction or director who has worked in the field hopes for when he or she uncaps a pen or a lens. Total emotional involvement, pretty much undiluted by any real thinking process. And you understand, don't you, that when it comes to horror movies, the only thought process really necessary to break the mood is for a friend to lean over and whisper, "See the zipper running down his back?" I think that only people who have worked in the field for some time truly understand how fragile this stuff really is and what an amazing commitment it imposes on the reader or viewer of intellect and maturity. When Coleridge spoke of
the suspension of disbelief in his essay on imaginative poetry, I believe he knew that disbelief is not like a balloon, which may be suspended in air with a minimum of effort. It is like a lead weight, which has to be hoisted with a clean and a jerk and held up by main force. Disbelief isn't light, it's heavy. The difference in sales between Arthur Haley and H.P. Lovecraft may exist because everyone believes in cars and banks, but it takes a sophisticated and muscular intellectual act to believe, even for a little while, in Nyarlathotep, the blind, faceless one, the howler in the night. And whenever I run into someone who expresses a feeling along the lines of, "I don't read fantasy or go to any of those movies, none of it's real," I feel a kind of sympathy. They simply can't lift the weight of fantasy. The muscles of the imagination have grown too weak. In this sense, kids are the perfect audience for horror. The paradox is this: children, who are physically quite weak, lift the weight of unbelief with ease. They are the jugglers of the invisible world, a perfectly understandable phenomenon when you consider the perspective they must view things from. Children deftly manipulate the logistics of Santa Claus's entry on Christmas Eve. He can get down small chimneys by making himself small, and if there's no chimney, there's the letter slot, and if there's no letter slot, there's always the crack under the door. The Easter Bunny. God. Big guy, sort of old, white beard, throne. Jesus. How do you think he turned the water into wine? I asked my son Joe when he, Joe, not Jesus, was 5. Joe's idea was that he had something kind of like magic Kool-Aid, you get what I mean? The devil. Big guy, red skin, horse feet, tail with an arrow on the end of it, snidely whiplash mustache. Ronald McDonald. The Burger King, the Keebler Elves, Dorothy and Toto, the Lone Ranger and Tonto, 1,000 more. Most parents think they understand this openness better than, in many cases, they actually do, and try to keep their children away from anything that smacks too much of horror and terror. Rated PG, or G in the case of the Andromeda strain, but may be too intense for younger children, the ads for Jaws read, believing, I suppose, that to allow their kids to go to a real horror movie would be tantamount to rolling a live hand grenade into a nursery school. But one of the odd Doppler effects that seems to occur during the selective forgetting that is so much a part of growing up is the fact that almost everything has a scare potential for the child under 8. Children are literally afraid of their own shadows at the right time and place. There is the story of the 4-year-old who refused to go to bed at night without a light on in his closet. His parents at last discovered he was frightened of a creature he had heard his father speak of often. This creature, which had grown large and dreadful in the child's imagination, was the Twi-Night Doubleheader. Seen in this light, even Disney movies are minefields of terror, and the animated cartoons, which will apparently be released and re-released even unto the end of the world, are usually the worst offenders. Dennis Etchison, see the forenote to this edition, writes, "Virtually all of the 3D movies made in the 50s were made using the Polaroid process. The only exception I know of is Robot Monster." The Polaroid process did not use red and green or red and blue glasses, but clear gray lenses. Hence, we were able to see many of the films in full Technicolor, since the glasses added no color of their own. The confusion arises because reissues of a select few black and white films, italics mine, in recent years have been in a single-strip, one-projector, red and green anaglyphic 3D, a cheapjack simulation of the original process. Every other 3D film we remember from the 50s was originally shown as Polaroid, with clear gray glasses. Dennis further points out that 3D is back with a vengeance. Parasite, Friday the 13th Part 3, Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, Treasure of the Four Crowns. He suggests that bipolarized permanent lenses are available for die-hard fans, but a theater manager suggested to me that a pair of off-the-rack Fostergrand polarized sunglasses, clip-ons if you were prescription specs, would do the trick nicely for under $12. Ain't modern technology wonderful? There are adults today who, when questioned, will tell you that the most frightening thing they saw at the movies as children was Bambi's mother shot by the hunter, or Bambi and his father running before the forest fire. Other Disney memories, which are right up there with the Batrachian horror inhabiting the Black Lagoon, include the marching brooms that have gone totally out of control in Fantasia. And for the small child, the real horror inherent in the situation is probably buried in the implied father-son relationship between Mickey Mouse and the old sorcerer. Those brooms are making a terrible mess, and when the sorcerer father gets home, there may be punishment. This sequence might well send the child of strict parents into an ecstasy of terror. The Night on Bald Mountain, from the same film. The witches in Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, one with her enticingly red poisoned apple. And what small child is not taught early to fear the idea of poison? The other with her deadly spinning wheel. This holds all the way up to the relatively innocuous 101 Dalmatians, which features the logical granddaughter of those Disney witches from the 30s and 40s, the evil Cruella de Vil, with her scrawny, nasty face, her loud voice. Grown-ups sometimes forget how terrified young children are of loud voices, which come from the giants of their world, the adults. And her plan to kill all the Dalmatian puppies, read children if you're a little person, and turn them into dogskin coats. Yet it is the parents, of course, who continue to underwrite the Disney procedure of release and re-release, often discovering goosebumps on their own arms as they rediscover what terrified them as children. Because what the good horror film, or horror sequence in what may be billed a comedy or an animated cartoon, does above all else is to knock the adult props out from under us and tumble us back down the slide into childhood. And there our own shadow may once again become that of a mean dog, a gaping mouth, or a beckoning dark figure. Perhaps the supreme realization of this return to childhood comes in David Cronenberg's marvelous horror film, The Brood, where a disturbed woman is literally producing children of rage, who go out and murder the members of her family, one by one. About halfway through the film, her father sits dispiritedly on the bed in an upstairs room, drinking and mourning his wife, who has been the first to feel the wrath of the brood. We cut to the bed itself, and clawed hands suddenly reach out from beneath it and dig into the carpeting near the doomed father's shoes. And so Cronenberg pushes us down the slide. We are four again, and all of our worst surmises about what might be lurking under the bed have turned out to be true. The irony of all this is that children are better able to deal with fantasy and terror on its own terms than their elders are. You'll note I've italicized the phrase, on its own terms. An adult is able to deal with the cataclysmic terror of something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre because he or she understands that it is all make-believe, and that when the take is done, the dead people will simply get up and wash off the stage blood. The child is not so able to make this distinction, and Chainsaw Massacre is quite rightly rated R. Little kids do not need this scene any more than they need the one at the end of The Fury where John Cassavetes quite literally blows apart. But the point is, if you put a little kid of six in the front row at a screening of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, along with an adult who is temporarily unable to distinguish between make-believe and real things, as Danny Torrance, the little boy in The Shining, puts it, if, for instance, you had given the adult a hit of Yellow Sunshine LSD about 2 hours before the movie started, my guess is that the kid would have maybe a week's worth of bad dreams. The adult might spend a year or so in a rubber room, writing home with Crayolas. A certain amount of fantasy and horror in a child's life seems to me a perfectly okay, useful sort of thing. Because of the size of their imaginative capacity, children are able to handle it. And because of their unique position in life, they are able to put such feelings to work. They understand their position very well, too. Even in such a relatively ordered society as our own, they understand that their survival is a matter almost totally out of their hands. Children are dependents up until the age of 8 or so in every sense of the word. Dependent on mother and father, or some reasonable facsimile thereof, not only for food, clothing, and shelter,
but dependent on them not to crash the car into a bridge abutment, to meet the school bus on time, to walk them home from Cub Scouts or Brownies, to buy medicines with childproof caps, dependent on them to make sure they don't electrocute themselves while screwing around with the toaster or while trying to play with Barbie's beauty salon in the bathtub. Running directly counter to this necessary dependence is the survival directive built into all of us. The child realizes his or her essential lack of control, and I suspect it is this very realization which makes the child uneasy. It is the same sort of free-floating anxiety that many air travelers feel. They are not afraid because they believe air travel to be unsafe. They are afraid because they have surrendered control. And if something goes wrong, all they can do is sit there clutching air sick bags or the in-flight magazine. To surrender control runs counter to the survival directive. Conversely, while a thinking, informed person may understand intellectually that travel by car is much more dangerous than flying, he or she is still apt to feel much more comfortable behind the wheel because he has control, or at least an illusion of it. This hidden hostility and anxiety toward the airline pilots of their lives may be one explanation why, like the Disney pictures which are released during school vacations in perpetuity, the old fairy tales also seem to go on forever. A parent who would raise his or her hands in horror at the thought of taking his or her child to see Dracula or The Changeling, with its pervasive imagery of the drowning child, would be unlikely to object to the babysitter reading Hansel and Gretel to the child before bedtime. But consider, the tale of Hansel and Gretel begins with deliberate abandonment. Oh yes, the stepmother masterminds that one, but she is the symbolic mother all the same, and the father is a spaghetti-brained nerd who goes along with everything she suggests, even though he knows it's wrong. Thus we can see her as amoral, him as actively evil in the biblical and Miltonian sense. It progresses to kidnapping, the witch in the candy house, enslavement, illegal detention, and finally justifiable homicide and cremation. Most mothers and fathers would never take their children to see Survive, that quickie Mexican exploitation flick about the rugby players who survived the aftermath of a plane crash in the Andes by eating their dead teammates. But these same parents find little to object to in Hansel and Gretel, where the witch is fattening the children up so she can eat them. We give this stuff to the kids almost instinctively, understanding on a deeper level, perhaps, that such fairy stories are the perfect points of crystallization for those fears and hostilities. Even anxiety-ridden air travelers have their own fairy tales. All those airport movies, which, like Hansel and Gretel and all those Disney cartoons, show every sign of going on forever, but which should only be viewed on Thanksgivings, since all of them feature a large cast of turkeys. My gut reaction to Creature from the Black Lagoon on that long-ago night was a kind of terrible waking swoon. The nightmare was happening right in front of me. Every hideous possibility that human flesh is heir to was being played out on that drive-in screen. Approximately 22 years later, I had a chance to see Creature from the Black Lagoon again, not on TV, with any kind of dramatic build and mood broken up by adverts for used cars, K-Tel disco anthologies, and Underalls pantyhose, thank God, but intact, uncut, and even in 3D. Guys like me who wear glasses have a hell of a time with 3D, you know. Ask anyone who wears specs how they like those nifty little cardboard glasses they give you when you walk in the door. If 3D ever comes back in a big way, I'm going to take myself down to the local Pearle Vision Center and invest $70 in a special pair of prescription lenses, one red, one blue. Annoying glasses aside, I should add that I took my son Joe with me. He was then 5, about the age I had been myself that night at the drive-in. And imagine my surprise, my rueful surprise, to discover that the movie, which had so terrified me on that long-ago night, have been rated G by the MPAA, just like the Disney pictures. In one of my favorite Arthur C. Clarke stories, this actually happens. In this vignette, aliens from space land on Earth after the big one has finally gone down. As the story closes, the best brains of this alien culture are trying to figure out the meaning of a film they have found and learned how to play back. The film ends with the words, "A Walt Disney production." I have moments when I really believe that there would be no better epitaph for the human race or for a world
where the only sentient being absolutely guaranteed of immortality is not Hitler, Charlemagne, Albert Schweitzer, or even Jesus Christ, but is instead Richard M. Nixon, whose name is engraved on a plaque placed on the airless surface of the moon. As a result, I had a chance to experience that weird doubling back in time that I believe most parents only experience at the Disney films with their children, or when reading them the Pooh books, or perhaps taking them to the Shrine or the Barnum and Bailey Circus. A popular record is apt to create a particular set in a listener's mind, precisely because of its brief life of 6 weeks to 3 months, and golden oldies continue to be played because they are the emotional equivalent of freeze-dried coffee. When the Beach Boys come on the radio singing Help Me, Rhonda, there is always that wonderful second or two when I can re-experience the wonderful, guilty joy of copping my first feel. And if you do the mental subtraction from my present age of 33, you'll see that I was a little backward in that respect. Movies and books do the same thing, although I would argue that the mental set, its depth and texture, tends to be a little richer, a little more complex when re-experiencing films, and a lot more complex when dealing with books. With Joe that day, I experienced Creature from the Black Lagoon from the other end of the telescope, but this particular theory of set identification still applied. In fact, it prevailed. Time and age and experience have all left their marks on me, just as they have on you. Time is not a river, as Einstein theorized. It's a big fucking buffalo herd that runs us down and eventually mashes us into the ground, dead and bleeding, with a hearing aid plugged into one ear and a colostomy bag instead of a 44 clapped on one leg. 22 years later, I knew that the creature was really good old Riku Browning, the famed underwater stuntman, in a molded latex suit and the suspension of disbelief, that mental clean and jerk had become a lot harder to accomplish. But I did it, which may mean nothing, or which may mean, I hope, that the buffalo haven't got me yet. But when that weight of disbelief was finally up there, the old feelings came flooding in, as they flooded in some 5 years ago when I took Joe and my daughter Naomi to their first movie, a reissue of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. There is a scene in that film where, after Snow White has taken a bite from the poisoned apple, the dwarfs take her into the forest, weeping copiously. Half the audience of little kids was also in tears. The lower lips of the other half were trembling. The set identification in that case was strong enough so that I was also surprised into tears. I hated myself for being so blatantly manipulated, but manipulated I was. And there I sat, blubbering into my beard over a bunch of cartoon characters. But it wasn't Disney that manipulated me. I did it myself. It was the kid inside who wept, surprised out of dormancy and into schmaltzy tears, but at least awake for a while. During the final two reels of Creature from the Black Lagoon, the weight of disbelief is nicely balanced somewhere above my head, and once again, director Jack Arnold places the symbols in front of me and produces the old equation of the fairy tales, each symbol as big and as easy to handle as a child's alphabet block. Watching, the child awakes again and knows that this is what dying is like. Dying is when the creature from the Black Lagoon dams up the exit. Dying is when the monster gets you. In the end, of course, the hero and the heroine, very much alive, not only survive but triumph, as Hansel and Gretel do. As the drive-in floodlights over the screen came on and the projector flashed its good-night drive-safely slide on that big white space, along with the virtuous suggestion that you attend the church of your choice, there was a brief feeling of relief, almost of resurrection. But the feeling that stuck longest was the swooning sensation that good old Richard Carlson and good old Julia Adams were surely going down for the third time, and the image that remains forever after is of the creature slowly and patiently walling its victims into the black lagoon. Even now I can see it peering over that growing wall of mud and sticks. Its eyes. Its ancient eyes. Chapter 5. Radio and the Set of Reality. Books and movies are all very well, and we'll come back to them before long, but before we do, I'd like to talk a little about radio in the mid-50s. I'll start with myself, and for me, we can hopefully progress to a more profitable general case. I am of the last quarter of the last generation that remembers radio drama as an active force, a dramatic art form with its own set of reality. This is a true statement as far as it goes, but of course it doesn't go anywhere near far enough. Radio's real golden age ended around 1950, the year at which this book's casual attempt at media history begins, the year I celebrated my third birthday and began my first full year of doing it in the potty. As a child of the media, I have been pleased to have attended the healthy birth of rock and roll and to have seen it grow up fast and healthy. But I was also in attendance during my younger years at the deathbed of radio as a strong fictional medium. Drama is still to be found on the radio, God knows. CBS Mystery Theater is a case in point, and there is even comedy, as every devoted follower of that abysmally inept superhero Chicken Man knows. But the Mystery Theater seems oddly flat, oddly dead, a curiosity only. There is none of the heavy emotional zap that used to come out of the radio when Inner Sanctum's creaking doors swung open each week, or during Dimension X, I Love a Mystery, or the early days of Suspense. Although I listen to Mystery Theater when I can, and happen to think that E.G. Marshall does a great job as host, I don't particularly recommend it. It is a fluke, like a Studebaker that still runs, poorly, or the last surviving Auk. Even more than these, CBS Mystery Theater is like an electrical power cable through which a heavy, almost lethal current used to run, and which now lies inexplicably cold and harmless. The Adventures of Chicken Man, a syndicated comedy program, works much better, but comedy, a naturally auditory as well as visual medium, often does. But the intrepid, klutzy Chicken Man is still something of an acquired taste, like taking snuff or eating escargot. My own favorite moment in Chicken Man's career occurs when he gets on the crosstown bus clad in boots, tights, and cape, only to discover that, since he has no pockets, he doesn't have a dime for the fare box. And for some people, Chicken Man doesn't work at all. My good friend, Mac McCutcheon, once played an album of the Great Fowl's adventures to a group of friends who simply sat and listened with polite, blank expressions on their faces. No one even chuckled. As Steve Martin says in The Jerk, "Take those snails off her plate and bring her the toasted cheese sandwich like I told you in the first place." And still, endearing as Chicken Man seems as he stumbles gamely from one abysmal situation to another, with his Jewish mother always close behind, bearing advice and chicken soup with matzo balls, he is never quite in focus for me, except maybe for that one priceless moment as he stands slumped before the bus driver, cape between his legs. I smile at Chicken Man. I have occasionally even chuckled. But there are never moments as gut-bustingly funny as the moments when Fibber McGee, as unstoppable as time itself, would approach his closet, or when Chester A. Riley would engage in long and uneasy conversations with his next-door neighbor, a mortician named Digger O'Dell. He sure is swell. Of the radio programs I remember with the most clarity, the only one which properly belongs in the Danse Macabre was Suspense, also presented by the CBS Radio Network. My grandfather, the one who worked for Winslow Homer as a young man, and I really presided at the death rattle of radio together. He was fairly hale and fairly hearty at the age of 82, but incomprehensible because he had a heavy beard and no teeth. He would talk, volubly at times, but only my mother could really understand what he was saying.
"Ginsen Grammer Francois Grapp?"
he might ask me as we sat listening to his old Philco table model. "That's right, Daddy Guy," I'd say, with not the slightest idea of what I'd agree to. Nonetheless, we had the radio to unite us. At this time, around 1958, my grandmother and grandfather lived together in a combination bed-sitting room that was a converted parlor, the biggest room in a small New England house. He was ambulatory, barely, but my grandmother was blind and bedridden and horribly corpulent, a victim of hypertension. Occasionally her mind would clear. Mostly she would go into long, excited rants, telling us that the horse needed to be fed, the fires needed to be banked, that someone had to get her up so she could bake pies for the elk's supper, Sometimes she talked to Flossie, one of my mother's sisters. Flossie had died of spinal meningitis 40 years ago. So the situation in that room was this. My grandfather was lucid, but incomprehensible. My grandmother was comprehensible, but far gone in senility. Somewhere in between was Daddy Guy's radio. On radio nights, I would bring in a chair and place it in my grandfather's corner of the room, and he would fire up one of his huge cigars. The gong would sound for suspense, or Johnny Dollar would begin to spin that week's tale through the unique, so far as I know, device of itemizing his expense account, or the voice of Bill Conrad as Matt Dillon would come on, deep and somehow unutterably weary.
It makes a man watchful and a little lonely.
For me, the smell of strong cigar smoke in a small room brings up its own set of ghost reference. Sunday night radio with my grandfather. The creak of batwing doors, the jingle of spurs, or the scream at the end of that classic suspense episode, "You Died Last Night." They died all right, one by one, that last handful of radio programs. Gunsmoke went first. TV audiences had associated the face of Matt Dillon, only imagined for the previous 10 years or so, with that of James Arnaz, Kitties with Amanda Blake, Docs with Milburn Stone, and Chester's, of course, with the face of Dennis Weaver. Their faces and their voices eclipsed the voices which came from the radio, and even now, 20 years later, it is the eager, slightly whining voice of Weaver that I associate with Chester Good, or as he was known on the radio series, Chester Proudfoot, as he comes hurrying up the Dodge City boardwalk with gimpy enthusiasm, calling,
"Mr. Dillon! Mr. Dillon! There's trouble down in the Long Branch!"
Johnny Darler, when a year or so later, he totted up his last expense account and drifted away into whatever limbo waits for retired insurance investigators. Suspense, the last of the grisly old horrors, died the same day as Johnny Darler, September 30, 1962. By then, TV had demonstrated its ability to produce its own horrors. Like Gunsmoke, Inner Sanctum had made the jump from radio to video, the swinging door finally visible. And visible, it certainly was horrible enough, slightly askew, festooned with cobwebs. But it was something of a relief just the same. Nothing could have looked as horrible as that door sounded. I'm going to avoid any long dissertation on just why radio died or in what ways it was superior to television in terms of the imaginational requirements it imposed on the listener, although we will touch briefly on some of this when we talk about the great Arch Obler, because radio drama has been rather overanalyzed and certainly over-eulogized. A little nostalgia is good for the soul, and I think I've already indulged in mine. But I do want to say something about imagination purely as a tool in the art and science of scaring the crap out of people. The idea isn't original with me. I heard it expressed by William F. Nolan at the 1979 World Fantasy Convention. "Nothing is so frightening as what's behind the closed door," Nolan said. You approach the door in the old deserted house, and you hear something scratching at it. The audience holds its breath along with the protagonist, as he, more often she, approaches that door. The protagonist throws it open, and there is a 10-foot-tall bug. The audience screams, but this particular scream has an oddly relieved sound to it. A bug 10 feet tall is pretty horrible, the audience thinks, but I can deal with a 10-foot-tall bug. I was afraid it might be 100 feet tall. Consider, if you will, the most frightening sequence in The Changeling. The heroine, Trish Vandeveer, has rushed off to the haunted house her new friend, George C. Scott, has rented, thinking he may need help. Scott is not there at all, but a series of small, stealthy sounds leads her to believe that he is. The audience watches, mesmerized, as Trish climbs to the second floor, the third floor, and finally she negotiates the narrow, cobwebby steps leading to the attic room where a young boy has been murdered in particularly nasty fashion some 80 years before. When she reaches the room, the dead boy's wheelchair suddenly whirls around and pursues her, chasing her screaming down all 3 flights of stairs, racing along after as she runs down the hall, to finally overturn near the front door. The audience screams as the empty wheelchair chases the lady, but the real scare has already happened. It comes as the camera dwells on those long, shadowy staircases, as we try to imagine walking up those stairs towards some as yet unseen horror waiting to happen. Bill Nolan was speaking as a screenwriter when he offered the example of the big bug behind the door, but the point applies to all media. What's behind the door or lurking at the top of the stairs is never as frightening as the door or the staircase itself. And because of this comes the paradox. The artistic work of horror is almost always a disappointment. It is the classic no-win situation. You can scare people with the unknown for a long, long time. The classic example, as Bill Nolan also pointed out, is the Jacques Tourneur film with Dana Andrews, Curse of the Demon. But sooner or later, as in poker, you have to turn your down cards up. You have to open the door and show the audience what's behind it. And if what happens to be behind it is a bug, not 10 but 100 feet tall, the audience heaves a sigh of relief, or utters a scream of relief, and thinks, "Ah, bug 100 feet tall is pretty horrible, but I can deal with that. I was afraid it might be 1,000 feet tall." The thing is, and a pretty good thing for the human race, too, with such neato-kino things to deal with as Dachau, Hiroshima, the Children's Crusade, mass starvation in Cambodia, and what happened in Jonestown, Guyana, the human consciousness can deal with almost anything, which leaves the writer or director of the horror tale with a problem, which is the psychological equivalent of inventing a faster-than-light space drive in the face of E equals MC squared. There is, and always has been, a school of horror writers, I am not among them, who believe that the way to beat this wrath is to never open the door at all. A classic example of this, it even involves a door, is the Robert Wise version of Shirley Jackson's novel, The Haunting of Hill House. The film and the book do not differ greatly in terms of plot, but they differ significantly, I think, in terms of thrust, point of view, and final effect. We were talking about radio, weren't we? Well, we'll get back to it, I guess, sooner or later. Later on, we will have some converse of Ms. Jackson's excellent novel. But for now, let's deal with the film. In it, an anthropologist, Richard Johnson, whose hobby is ghost hunting, invites a party of three to summer with him at the infamous Hill House, where any number of nasty things have occurred in the past and where, from time to time, ghosts may or may not have been seen. The party includes two ladies who have previously experienced aspects of the invisible world, Julie Harris and Claire Bloom, and the happy-go-lucky nephew of the present owner, played by Russ Tamblyn, that old dancing fool from the film version of West Side Story. The housekeeper, Mrs. Dudley, offers each her simple, bone-chilling catechism as they arrive. "No one lives any closer than town. No one will come any closer than that. So no one will hear you if you scream in the night, in the dark." Of course, Mrs. Dudley has proved absolutely right, and that right early. The four of them experience a steadily escalating run of horrors, and happy-go-lucky Luke ends by saying that the property he has so looked forward to inheriting should be burned flat and the ground seeded with salt. For our purposes here, the interesting thing lies in the fact that we never actually see whatever it is that haunts Hill House. Something is there, all right. Something holds hands with terrified Eleanor in the night. She thinks it's Theo, but finds out the next day that Theo hasn't even been close to her. Something knocks on the wall with a sound like cannon fire. And most apropos to where we are now, this same something causes a door to bulge grotesquely inward until it looks like a great convex bubble, a sight so unusual to the eye that the mind reacts with horror. In Nolan's terms, something is scratching at the door. In a very real way, in spite of fine acting, fine direction, and the marvelous black-and-white photography of David Bolton, what we have in the Wise film, title shortened to The Haunting, is one of the world's few radio horror movies. Something is scratching at that ornate paneled door, something horrible. But it is a door Wise elects never to open. Lovecraft would open the door, but only a crack. Here is the final entry of Robert Blake's diary in the story, The Haunter of the Dark, which was dedicated to Robert Bloch.
Sense of distance gone. Far as near and near as far. No light, no glass. See that steeple, that tower, window. Can hear Roderick Usher. A mad or going mad. The thing is stirring and fumbling in the tower. I am it, and it is I. I want to get out. Must get out and unify the forces. It knows where I am. I am Robert Blake, but I see the tower in the dark. There is a monstrous odor, senses transfigured, boarding at that tower window, cracking and giving way. I see it coming here. Hell wind, titan blur, black wings. Yog-Sothoth, save me! The three-lobed burning eye!
So the tale ends, leaving us with only the vaguest intimations of what Robert Blake's haunter may have been. I cannot describe it, protagonist after protagonist tells us. If I did, you would go mad with fear. But somehow I doubt that. I think both Wise and Lovecraft before him understood that to open the door, in 99 cases out of 100, is to destroy the unified, dreamlike effect of the best horror. I can deal with that, the audience says to itself, settling back, and bang, you just lost the ballgame in the bottom of the ninth. My own disapproval of this method, we'll let the door bulge, but we'll never open it, comes from the belief that it is playing to tie rather than to win. There is, or may be, after all, that 100th case, and there is the whole concept of suspension of disbelief. Consequently, I'd rather yank the door open at some point during the festivities. I'd rather turn my whole cards face up. And if the audience screams with laughter rather than terror, if they see the zipper running up the monster's back, then you just gotta go back to the drawing board and try it again. The exciting thing about radio at its best was that it bypassed the whole question of whether to open the door or leave it closed. Radio, by the very nature of the medium, was exempt. For the listeners, during the years 1930 to 1950 or so, there were no visual expectations to fulfill in their set of reality. What about this set of reality, then? Another example, for purposes of comparison and contrast, from the movies. One of the classic fright films that I consistently missed as a child was Val Lewton's Cat People, directed by Jacques Tourneur. Like Freaks, it is one of those movies that comes up when the conversation among fans turns to what makes a great horror movie. Others would include Curse of the Demon, Dead of Night, and The Creeping Unknown, I suppose, but for now let's stick with the Lewton film. It's one that a great many people remember with affection and respect from their childhoods, one that scared the crap out of them. Two specific sequences from the film are always brought up. Both involve Jane Randolph, the good girl, menaced by Simone Simon, the bad girl, who is, let's be fair, no more willfully evil than his poor old Larry Talbot and the Wolfman. In one, Ms. Randolph is trapped in a deserted basement swimming pool while somewhere nearby and getting closer all the time, a great jungle cat menaces her. In the other sequence, she is walking through Central Park and the cat is getting closer and closer, getting ready to spring. We hear a hard coughing roar, which turns out only to be the air brakes of an arriving bus. Ms. Randolph steps onto it, leaving the audience limp with relief and with the feeling that a horrible disaster has been averted by inches. In terms of what it does psychologically, I wouldn't argue the thesis that The Cat People is a good, perhaps even a great, American film. It is almost certainly the best horror film of the 40s. At the base of the myth of the cat people, werecats if you like, is a deep sexual fear. Irena, Ms. Simon, has been convinced as a child that any outpouring of passion will cause her to change into a cat. Nevertheless, she marries Kent Smith, who is so smitten that he takes her to the altar even though we pretty much understand he'll be spending his wedding night, and many nights thereafter, sleeping on the couch. No wonder the poor guy eventually turns to Jane Randolph. But to return to those two scenes, the one in the swimming pool works quite well. Luton and his director Jacques Tourneur were, like Stanley Kubrick, masters of contest here, lighting the scene to perfection and controlling every variable. We feel the truth of that scene everywhere, from the tiled walls, the lap of the water in the pool, to that slightly flat echo when Ms. Randolph speaks to ask that time-honored horror movie question, "Who's there?" And I am sure the Central Park scene worked for audiences of the 40s, but today it simply will not wash. Even out in the sticks, audiences would hoot and laugh at it. I finally saw the movie as an adult, and puzzled for some time over what all the shouting could have been about. I think I finally figured out why that Central Park stalking scene worked then but doesn't work now. It has something to do with what film technicians call state-of-the-art. But this is only the technician's way of referring to that thing I have called visual set, or the set of reality. If you should get a chance to see the cat people on TV or at a revival house in or near your city, pay particular attention to that sequence where Irena stalks Jane Randolph as Ms. Randolph hurries to catch her bus. Take a moment to look at it closely, and you'll see it is not Central Park at all. It's a set built on a soundstage. A little thought will suggest a reason why. Tourneur, who wanted to be in control of lighting at all times, didn't elect to shoot on set. He simply had no choice. William F. Nolan, mentioning this film, said that the memory which remained with him most strongly from the Central Park sequence was the pattern of light, shadow, light, shadow, light, shadow, as the camera moves with Ms. Randolph, and it is indeed a fine, eerie effect. The state of the art in 1942 did not allow for night shooting on location, so instead of shooting in daylight with a heavy filter, a technique that shows up as even more glaringly faked, Tourneur quite sensibly opted for the soundstage, and it is interesting to me that some 40 years later, Stanley Kubrick did exactly the same thing with The Shining. And like Luton and Tourneur before him, Kubrick is a director who shows an almost exquisite sensitivity to the nuances of light and shadow. To theatrical audiences of the time, there was no false note in this. They were used to integrating movie sets into their imaginative processes. Sets were simply accepted, the way we might accept a single piece of scenery or two in a play that calls, as Thornton Wilder's Our Town does, for mostly bare stage. This is an acceptance that the Victorian playgoer would simply have balked at. He or she might accept the principle of the bare stage, but emotionally the play would lose most of its effect and its charm. The Victorian playgoer would be apt to find Our Town outside her or his set of reality. For me, the scene in Central Park lost its believability for the same reason. As the camera moves with Ms. Randolph, everything surrounding her screams, "Fake! Fake! Fake!" to my eye. While I was supposed to be worrying about whether or not Jane Randolph was going to be attacked, I found myself worrying instead about that papier-mâché stone wall in the background. When the bus finally pulls up, the chuff of its air brakes miming the cat's cheated growl, I was wondering if it was hard getting that New York City bus onto a closed soundstage and if the bushes in the background were real or plastic. The set of reality changes, and the boundaries of that mental country where the imagination may be fruitfully employed, Rod Serling's apt phrase for it, now a part of the American idiom, was the Twilight Zone, are in near constant flux. By the 1960s, the decade when I saw more movies than I ever have since, the state of the art had advanced to a point where a set and sound stages had become nearly obsolete. New fast films had made available light shooting perfectly possible. In 1942, Val Luton could not shoot in Central Park by night, but in Barry Lyndon, Stanley Kubrick shot several scenes by candlelight. This is a quantum technical leap, which has this paradoxical effect. It robs the bank of imagination. Perhaps realizing the fact, Kubrick takes a giant step backward to the soundstage with his next film, The Shining. Want more proof of how the set of reality changes, whether we want it to or not? Remember Bonanza, which ran on NBC for 1,000 years or so? Check it out in syndication someday. Look at that Ponderosa set, the front yard, the big family room, and ask yourself how you ever believed it was real. It seemed real because we were used to seeing TV series shot on sound stages up until 1965 or so. Nowadays, even TV producers don't use sound stages for exteriors. The state of the art has, for better or worse, moved on. All of this may seem far afield from the subject of radio drama and the question of whether or not to open the door on the monster, but we're really standing right next to both subjects. As movie audiences of the 40s and 50s believed Luton's Central Park set, so radio listeners believed what the announcers, the actors, and the soundmen told them. The visual set was there, but it was plastic, bound by very few hard and fast expectations. When you made the monster in your mind, there was no zipper running down its back. It was a perfect monster. Audiences of today listening to old tapes don't accept the make-believe ballroom any more than I am able to accept Luton's papier-mâché rock wall. We are simply hearing a 1940s DJ playing records in a studio. But to audiences of a different day, the make-believe ballroom was more real than make-believe. You could imagine the men in their tuxedos, the women in their gowns and smooth elbow-length gloves, the flaring wall sconces, and Tommy Dorsey, resplendent in white dinner jacket, conducting. Or in the case of the infamous Orson Welles broadcast of The War of the Worlds, a Mercury Theater Halloween presentation, and that was a trick-or-treat millions of Americans never forgot, you could broaden that country of the imagination enough to send people screaming into the streets. On TV, it wouldn't have worked, but on the radio, there were no zippers running down the Martians' backs. Radio avoided the open-door, closed-door question, I think, because radio deposited to that bank of imagination rather than making withdrawals in the name of state-of-the-art. Radio made it real. 2. My first experience with real horror came at the hands of Ray Bradbury. It was an adaptation of his story, Mars is Heaven, on Dimension X. This would have been broadcast around 1951, which would have made me 4 at the time. I asked to listen, and was denied permission by my mother. "It's on too late," she said, "and it would be much too upsetting for a little boy your age." At some other time, Mom told me that one of her sisters almost cut her wrists in the bathtub during the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast. My aunt was not going about it hastily. She could look out the bathroom window and had, she said later, no plans at all to make the cuts until she saw the Martian death machines looming on the horizon. I guess you could say my aunt had found the Welles broadcast too upsetting, and my mother's words echoed down to me over the years like a voice in an uneasy dream that has never really ended. Too upsetting, upsetting, upsetting. I crept down to the door to listen anyway, and she was right. It was plenty upsetting. Space travelers land on Mars, only it isn't Mars at all. It's good old Greentown, Illinois, and is inhabited by all the Voyager's dead friends and relatives. Their mothers are here, their sweethearts, good old Clancy the patrolman, Miss Henry's from the second grade. On Mars, Lou Gehrig is still pounding them over the fences for the Yankees. Mars is heaven, the space travelers decide. The locals take the crew of the spaceship into their homes, where they sleep the sleep of those perfectly at peace, full of hamburgers and hot dogs and Mom's apple pie. Only one member of the crew suspects the unspeakable obscenity, and he's right. Boy, is he right! And yet even he has awakened to the realization of this deadly illusion too late, because in the night these well-loved faces begin to drip and run and change. Kind, wise eyes become black tar pits of murderous hate. The rosy apple cheeks of Grandma and Grandpa lengthen and turn yellow. Noses elongate into wrinkled trunks. Mouths become gaping maws. It is a night of creeping horror, a night of hopeless screams and belated terror. Because Mars isn't heaven after all. Mars is a hell of hate and deception and murder. I didn't sleep in my bed that night. That night I slept in the doorway where the real and rational light of the bathroom bulb could shine on my face. That was the power of radio at its height. The shadow, we were assured at the beginning of each episode, had the power to cloud men's minds.
It strikes me that when it comes to fiction in the media, it is television and movies which so often cloud that part of our minds where the imagination moves most fruitfully. They do so by imposing the dictatorship of the visual set. If you view imagination as a mental creature of 100 different possible forms, imagine, if you will, Larry Talbot, not just condemned to turn into a wolfman at the full of the moon, but into an entire bestiary on successive nights, everything from a were-shark to a were-flea, then one of the forms is that of a rampaging gorilla, a creature that is dangerous and totally out of control. If this seems fanciful or melodramatic, think of your own children, or the children of close friends. Never mind your own childhood. You may remember events that took place then with some fidelity, but most of your memories of how the emotional weather was then will be utterly false. And of the times when they simply find themselves unable to turn off the second-floor light, or go down into the cellar, or maybe even bring a coat from the closet, because they saw or heard something that frightened them. And not necessarily a movie or a TV program, either. I've mentioned the fearsome Twilight doubleheader already. John D. MacDonald tells the story of how for weeks his son was terrified of something he called the Green Ripper. MacDonald and his wife finally figured it out. At a dinner party, a friend had mentioned the Grim Reaper. What their son had heard was Green Ripper. And later it became the title of one of MacDonald's Travis McGee stories. A child may be frightened by such a wide sweep of things that adults generally understand that to worry about this overmuch is to endanger all relations with the child. You begin to feel like a soldier in the middle of a minefield. Added to this is another complicating factor. Sometimes we frighten our kids on purpose. Someday, we say, a man in a black car may stop and offer you a suite to take a ride with him, and that is a bad man. Read The Bogeyman. And if he stops for you, you must never, never, never. Or, instead of giving that tooth to the tooth fairy, Jenny, let's put it in this glass of Coke. Tomorrow morning that tooth will be all gone. The Coke will dissolve it. So think about it the next time you have a quarter and... Or, little boys who play with matches wet the bed. They just can't help it. So don't you... Or that old-time favorite... Don't put that in your mouth. You don't know where it's been. Most children deal with their fears quite well. Most of the time, anyway. The shape-changing of their imaginations is so wide, so marvelously varied, that the gorilla pops out of the deck only infrequently. Besides worrying about what might be in the closet or under the bed, they have to imagine themselves as firefighters and policemen. Imagination as the very gentle, perfect knight. As mothers and nurses. As superheroes of various stripes and types, as their own parents, dressed up in attic clothes and giggling hand in hand before a mirror which shows them the future in the most unthreatening way. They need to experience a whole range of emotions from love to boredom, try them out like new shoes. But every now and then the gorilla gets out. Children understand that this face of their imagination must be caged. It's only a movie. That couldn't really happen, could it? Or as Judith Vihorst writes in one of her fine children's books, my mom says there are no ghosts, vampires, and zombies, but their cages are of necessity more flimsy than those their elders build. I do not believe there are people out there with no imagination at all, although I have come to believe that there are a few who lack even the most rudimentary sense of humor, but it sometimes seems that way. Perhaps because some people seem to build not just cages for the gorilla, but Chase Manhattan Bank-type safes, complete with time locks. I remarked to an interviewer once that most great writers have a curious childish look to their faces, and that this seems even more pronounced in the faces of those who write fantasy. It is perhaps most noticeable in the face of Ray Bradbury, who retains very strongly the look of the boy he was in Illinois. His face retains this indefinable look, in spite of his 60-plus years, his graying hair, his heavy glasses. Robert Bloch has the face of a sixth-grade cut-up, the class clown, don't you know, although he is past 60. Just how far past, I would not venture to guess. He might send Norman Bates after me. It is the face of the kid who sits in the back of the classroom, at least until the teacher assigns him a place up front, which usually doesn't take long, and makes screeching sounds on the top of his desk with the palms of his hands. Harlan Ellison has the face of a tough inner-city kid, confident enough in himself to be kind in most cases, but more than able to fuck you over royally if you give him any shit. But perhaps the look I'm trying to describe, or indicate, actual description is really impossible, is most visible on the face of Isaac Bashevis Singer, who, while regarded as a straight writer of literature by the critical establishment, has nonetheless made the cataloging of devils, angels, demons, and dibbocks a good part of his career. Grab a Singer book and take a good look at the author photo. You can read the book, too, when you're done looking at Singer's picture, okay? It is the face of an old man, but that is a surface so thin you could read a newspaper through it. The boy is beneath, stamped very clearly on his features. It's in his eyes, mostly. They are young and clear. One of the reasons for these young faces may be that writers of fantasy rather like the gorilla. They have never taken the trouble to strengthen the cage, and as a result, part of them has never accomplished the imaginative going away that is so much a part of growing up, of establishing the tunnel vision so necessary for a successful career as an adult. One of the paradoxes of fantasy horror is that the writer of this stuff is like the lazy pigs who built their houses of straw and sticks, but instead of learning their lesson and building sensible brick houses like their oh-so-adult elder brother, memorialized in his engineer's cap forever in my memory by the Disney cartoon, the writer of fantasy horror simply rebuilds with sticks and straw again. Because, in a crazy kind of way, he or she likes it when the wolf comes and blows it all down. Just as he or she sort of likes it when the gorilla escapes from its cage. Most people aren't fantasy writers, of course, but almost all of us recognize the need to feed the imagination some of the stuff from time to time. People seem to recognize that the imagination somehow needs a dose of it, like vitamins or iodized salt to avoid goiter. Fantasy is salt for the mind. Earlier on, I talked about the suspension of disbelief, Coleridge's classic definition of what the reader must provide when seeking a hot shot from a fantasy story, novel, or poem. Another way of putting this is that the reader must agree to let the gorilla out of its cage for a while, and when we see the zipper running up the monster's back, the gorilla goes promptly back into its cage. After all, by the time we get to be 40 or so, it's been in there for a long time, and perhaps it's developed a bit of the old institutional mentality. Sometimes it has to be prodded out with a stick, and sometimes it won't go at all.